Hello again, friends, and you are my friends, and welcome to another edition of 605, the Super Podcast, the only podcast on Turner Time, the Mothership, the best wrestling podcast on the planet. I am your host, the great Brian Last. With me, my co-host, David Bixenspan. Bix, how are you today?
I'm doing well, you?
I'm doing okay. I have a little bit of a sore throat, which may affect the presence of Denim Fritz today, but we'll see how that works out. But before we go any further here at the top of the show, there is a show announcement we need to make that is very important. A little bit of background on this show. This show, you know, I always say it's a full-time thing and it takes a lot of time. I don't think people realize that. I'm not joking. It's legit. I'm spending minimum 40 hours a week on this show, and Bix does just a mammoth job producing this thing beyond having to deal with all my various, you know, last second requests and things. Bix spends an inordinate amount of time editing the show together, recording the show, editing it together, and just getting everything set so that it's up on I was gonna say Wednesday night, but I guess technically it's Thursday morning at midnight. Each and every week. And it's something where I think, and I know a lot of you go back and listen to the early episodes and have been with us since the early episodes and have just gone back and splurged on them. But it sounds like a Larry Nelson kind of thing. But you realize that the workload has increased a lot. The show has become just such an animal that the recording, you know, it's now usually around 4 hours every week. There are multiple elements, multiple sound bites being played throughout the program. There are multiple segments played throughout the program. In between each episode, it's a lot of time spent just recording interviews. You know, it takes me a while to set up an interview, and then we have to record an interview. And usually you may hear only 45 minutes or 50 minutes on the air, but it takes a lot longer than that. I think we spoke to Polish Joe for close to 3 hours. I think we spoke to Bobby Simmons for close to 4 hours. Mark Aline from beginning to end was probably just under 2 hours. So each one of these things takes a lot of time. And as all this has been going on, and 605 has been a work in progress, a major success, our own David Bixenspan has become increasingly popular and busy in his world. You know, Bix has, it's weird for me because I've known Bix for a while, and I remember when he just first started really writing stuff, you know, under his real name, not under these aliases and hitting himself in the head with pots and pans or anything like that.
I didn't hit myself in the head.
Come on. I want to believe Travis Heckle just did some artwork. We'll talk about it a little later.
Oh, really?
Hotheads for Abdullah. And it's people with pots on their heads hitting themselves in the head with pots. So that's kind of how I want to picture it. But Bix is, you know, I'm sure you've all noticed it's one gig after another. He's done incredible. He's been very successful. He's writing now and jump in and correct me because sometimes I get the names wrong, but you're writing for Vice. Mm-hmm. You're writing for Motherboard.
Those are the Motherboard's part of Vice, but yes.
Okay, Motherboard's part of Vice. You're writing for Legal News, Law News, excuse me.
With the Z.
Law News with TV's Dan Abrams, as yes. You've pointed out. You're, of course, doing Figure Four weekly every week, which I think you've done a great job, and you've been one of the leaders. And actually, I shouldn't say one of. You've been the main person in professional wrestling covering the Hulk Hogan Gawker trial, which has also, you know, caused you to have a lot more exposure and get a lot more gigs with other sources, other people who are looking for articles. And you've branched out now. You're not even just doing wrestling stuff. You're doing a lot of legal stuff and a lot of just interesting stories and things you can uncover. And it's something you're really good at. But you know, the casualty in all this work is that it's hard for Bix to have the time to do 605 the way we've been doing it. And like I said, you know what this is. It started off, it was one thing, and now it's 4 hours every week with multiple segments, multiple bits, multiple sound bites, and a benign taskmaster in myself behind the scenes trying to push things forward and plan things out. So I think at this point, Bix, you know, jump in here, but due to your commitments, and it's commitments not just in writing, but you're also doing other podcasts and not just other ones that are currently there, but you're working on other things, you're developing things that I guess I'll leave it to you now. What do you want to say here?
So for now, I guess what's the best way to put this? This is my last show as the co-host. I will continue to be on the show doing the what ifs and the listener questions with you, not necessarily every week, but on a regular basis. Is that the best way to phrase that, I guess?
Well, when we do those bits, it is my hope. I shouldn't say bits, but when we do those segments, it is my hope that you will be available for many of them. And that is my intention. And that is, I think, what we're going to be doing. Bix will no longer be the co-host each and every week on the show. He will no longer be producing the show anymore, which, you know, the big thing to take out of that is if there are many audio mistakes going forward, please take it easy on me. I'm learning this stuff. I've never dealt with any of this stuff before, and it's going to be a real work in progress. The show's about to take a very interesting turn here. But Bix, in no way will you not hear Bix on the show anymore. He'll be on for various segments, maybe even beyond the what if segments at different times. And certainly as his career continues to blossom and as he has various wrestling things to talk about, we would love to have him back here on the show to talk about those as well. So it's not really a goodbye as much as it's, you know, we'll see you later. I guess that's the best way to put it. Right, Bix?
Yeah. And I mean, part of it is that of all the shows I do, this one is the most produced, for lack of a better term. Everything else I do is pretty much live to tape. There are shows I do where if I'm breaking them up into parts as I'm recording them, often I can just edit them as we're recording. I can't really do that with this show. So it becomes more and more of a... I was going to say time suck, but that sounds much more negative than I intend it.
Hey, fuck you.
But
Did I ever tell you about the time I had a time suck with Tiger G Singh?
There we go. So that's where it is. It's, you know, I'm still going to be doing basically everything else for now. It's just because this one is more of a, I mean, because of your vision for the show, where this is more of a show, a more of a radio show type show. It requires a lot more, and just right now, it doesn't look like I can give that degree of attention to it.
That's right. So moving forward, starting next week, I will be attempting to produce the show too. I'm certain I'm going to need a lot of help from people like Bix, a lot of help from everyone to make sure that the Super Podcast stays as it is. I'm looking for everything else to kind of stay the same with the show. But who knows? It may not be that Bix was the only person that accidentally hit the Yo Mamba soundbite when he meant to hit It's Not My Dad or whatever. So that may
Yo
be.
Yo Mamba!
Yeah, there you go. And I said, It's Not My Dad. I meant, That's Not My Dad. That'll be starting next week. But like I said, Bix has done a fantastic job from day one. This show started off as just two friends talking about wrestling, and it very quickly grew to have a huge following and very quickly grew to transform into what the show currently is, which is informative and humorous with multiple segments. Things that are really worked on. You know, I think if you listen to the show, you realize how much work goes into the actual segments, the actual content on air. And it is a lot and it is a time consuming thing. I'm very fortunate that I'm in a position where I can dedicate my time to this. And Bix just gets busier and busier and busier. And before you know it, he'll be writing for, you know, the Daily News or something. Actually, maybe that's not a good thing because I think they're going out of business or something. But yeah, so that's where we are now. Please, I think maybe we'll do on Facebook a favorite Bix moments. Favorite Bix moments thread. So stay tuned for that in the next few days. But, you know, with this announcement, Bix, with the announcement that you're no longer going to be the co-host on the show and no longer going to be here every week, that makes today's top 10 a little special. You get to say goodbye to all your favorites, one after another after another. And let me just say my intention going forward is I will have a revolving door of guests for the top 10, not just guests for the show for interview segments or anything else, but guests for the top 10. Maybe it'll be some people who have been on the show before. Maybe it'll be some listeners. You know, all you guys are funny and contribute, and I know the show's a big part of your lives. Maybe we'll have you guys come on the show as well and join in the fun for the top 10. But that's my intention going forward. The top 10 section of the program will have a revolving door of different people, different voices to talk to the different characters in the super universe. But with that, Bix, it's time for the top 10. This week we took write-ins, and man, some of these write-ins are crazy. But we'll get into that shortly. But number 10 on the list this week, bulk denim.
Big drop.
I think he was like number 3 or 4 last week. Do I have last week's show here? What is this? This is not that. I don't know where last week's show format sheet is, but big drop, bulk denim, number 10. He's dropping fast.
Bulk denim. You keep pronouncing it wrong.
Number 9, hot Bruno. Bruno.
Why are you cracking up so much? What do you have in mind?
I was just going to ask him something benign, and that's the second time we used the word benign. Now it's 3 on the program today. But Bruno, how much is Bix going to miss Sue the Shooter?
I'll tell you.
He'll tell us. But there's Hot Bruno. We'll leave it with that for this week. Hot Bruno, number 9. Number 8. I'm so happy this guy moved up just a little bit. Santo Gold. Now, I went to my friend's house the other day. Suzanne has a friend, Fabiola, and Fabiola's boyfriend, John. We all get together. We're couples that get together. And we were over here a while back for a barbecue, and we were all drinking, having a good time. And I said, hey, Sue, I'm going to show them Santo Gold. And she got really mad at me because she
– of course she did.
Because she hates Santo Gold. She hates the fact that I have the kids singing that song. But I put Santo Gold on, and – they both found it fascinating. Fabiola, you know, tapped out after a few minutes, but John got to the point where his screensaver on his phone is now Santo Gold, and he's turned his whole family onto it. And she is like really upset because he's constantly talking about it and singing it. And, you know, like every time she posts something on Facebook, like, oh, look at this new watch I got. Albright, is that a Santo Gold? You know, she gets really, really mad. So spreading the word of Santo Gold. And hopefully we'll have some more stuff about him soon here on the show. Unfortunately, once again, no one involved with Blood Circus is willing to speak about Blood Circus.
Does that really surprise you? Does it really?
It does. It doesn't for the people who are tied to the top of the production chain. I can understand why they wouldn't if they don't have a sense of humor. But I think if I was involved in this wacky thing, I would want to talk about it and share my experience with other people.
Well, but have you examined the making of to try to determine every single wrestler who was in it, like in detail, like freeze frames and all that?
I've done my best. I think I said a while back, there's a scene in the making of where it's Santo Gold going over the script with Scott Casey and Eric Embry, which I thought was interesting. Ox Baker plays a Russian. Which, you know, seems actually not like the – I don't know. That's not how
I – Bald and hairy.
Yeah, I don't know. That's not how I'd use Ock Big. I don't know who the mummy is. Voodoo Malumba, which, of course, is Big Red Reese. Nancy Sullivan as the Fallen Angel is in there, and she looks great. Who else? Scott Casey, Eric Embry. I know I'm forgetting some people, but actually, when I watch the wrestling clips, the thing I keep thinking is I'd love to see the Eric Embry stuff because he looks like he's really great in you know, just the wrestling scenes alone. Mm-hmm. But hopefully I'll get one of these people out. I don't know if you saw this, Bix, but one of the greatest things Travis Heckle did ever was last week. Yeah, you know where I'm going. Last week on the program, we talked about how it started in the Santo Gold segment, and we talked about his claim that he wore 30 pounds of gold around his neck, and that was the same claim that Mr. T made, and somehow, and this is what happens on this show, it led you to researching and bumping into the Mr. T roast that Dean Martin did, which is in the video playlist from last week, and that's the best video playlist I think we've ever had. So after that, Travis did artwork of a Santo Gold Dean Martin roast. And it's at facebook.com/superpodcast. You go look there and you can see the artwork. And on the dais is Jim J. Bullock, Vicky from Small Wonder, the robot girl, and then Groucho Marx and Dom DeLuise. And it's just, it's the best. It's just the best. It's the greatest thing ever. The Santo Gold face is amazing. And I think it's my favorite Travis Heckle artwork of all time.
It's up there.
It's up there.
It's up there. I don't know if it's my absolute personal favorite, but it's up there.
By, you know, on the topic of the video playlist and the artwork, Like I said, last week's video playlist is just so loaded with cool stuff. Various Express tag teams, best and worst managers. We'll talk a little bit shortly in a little while about various Captain Lou Albano commercials for hotlines. And I mentioned Small Wonder. The episode of Small Wonder with Jesse Ventura as Wally the Wimp. That is in the video playlist. So if you've never seen Small Wonder and you heard us talk about it, or you want to revisit this, you know, fairly awful show, although I still watch it, and see Jesse Ventura make a cameo appearance in 1987, that's in last week's video playlist, which, of course, is at facebook.com/superpodcast.
I have a question.
Yes.
Did you see when I tweeted on, like, Sunday morning a couple weeks ago while watching Small Wonder on Antenna TV or whichever it is that shows it?
No.
I was live tweeting the Say No to Drugs episode of Small Wonder.
I don't remember that one. Who's saying no to drugs? The little boy or Vicky the robot or Harriet the annoying neighbor?
Okay, so one of those child drug dealers that only exist on TV and in PSAs tries to give, I guess it was some kind of pills and was implied to be speed, and tries to sell it to Vicky, and he ends up giving to her for free because, again, that happens on TV and in PSAs, and it leads to Vicky and her human brother going undercover to bust the drug dealer for the police, and Vicky lifting the drug dealer. Well, it wasn't a kid drug dealer. It was like a teenager. And well, of course, the cops sense. Are like, well, you know, a lot of these kids are dealing drugs just to support their own habits. And she ends up lifting him up over her head.
That's her
one
move.
Hand.
Yeah, that's her move. That's like her move. You know, she'll shake your hand and just lift you up by your hand. That's what she beats up Jesse Ventura pretty good in that episode of with Wally the Wimp.
But it's amazing just how the parents are just so gung ho about their kids doing an undercover drug deal.
You didn't say that part. I didn't realize that. I thought they were undercover from even the parents.
No. The parents are like, well, okay.
Only the 80s. That's very 1980s. Was there a Different Strokes episode where same thing happened?
I don't know if I've ever seen the whole Different Strokes episode. You're talking about the Nancy Reagan one, right?
Was it? You know, maybe I'm thinking of the one where Gary Coleman's friend gets molested by the guy and...
Well, where are you going with this?
I'm just saying, like, the whole, like, kids having stings episode of a show.
Oh, was there like a sting, or are they just caught in the middle of everything in the Bicycle Man episode? I'm not sure. But I love in the Different Strokes one, like I said, I don't think I've ever seen the whole episode, but I've seen the clip where Nancy Reagan is talking to the classroom, and she's like, how many of you have ever tried, I forget if it's drugs in general or specifically marijuana, and this little mop-topped moppet just raises his hand and is like, I have, Mrs. Reagan.
Of course. Oh, that's great. I gotta say, I think the theme of Different Strokes is my all-time favorite television theme. That's up there. That and Car 54. Those are right up there at the top of my list of best television themes of all time.
No, but nothing Mike Post written or composed or what. Whatever words I was trying to get out of my mouth just now.
I think you're thinking composed. Nah, I'll go with Different Strokes, which I think was composed by Alan Thicke, believe it or not. And I think that is just a fantastic song. Like, I love that song. I have it on my iPod. Like, I actually play that in my car sometimes. I love the theme song to Different Strokes. But
nothing by Mike Post, though, really.
Well, what would Mike Post have that I would like?
NYPD Blue?
I like the theme songs with words that get catchy. NYPD okay. Blue isn't catchy. Car 54 is catchy. There's a hold up in the Bronx. Brooklyn's broken out and fight. I mean, that's catchy.
Okay, but how about catchy even if there are no words? Now, this isn't a Mike Post song, but like the Barney Miller theme, for example.
Yes, I love the Barney Miller theme. No, it's not Quincy Jones. That's Sanford and Son. But I love the Barney Miller theme.
Great bass line.
Yeah, I love everything about Barney Miller, to be quite honest with you. That's one of the great shows that's on Antenna TV now. which is good because I hadn't seen it in probably close to 28 years or so. I hadn't seen that on television out here. So it's wonderful that that's back on TV. But different strokes for different folks. Number 8, Santo Gold. This is the second Santo Gold in a row where we just went off on a weird television tirade.
There's nothing else to say.
This is the new Santo Gold thing. It's just talk about TV. Number 7 is this week's only write-in candidate to crack the top 10, which of course means further inclusion in the top 10. He's eligible to be voted on each and every week now. The Eye of Gibson. Now, this man has been certainly wanting to be in the top 10 for a while. He's him and the mullet of Morton been on Twitter actively campaigning to get in the top 10. And the Eye of Gibson is now, for those of you who aren't in on this gag, the Eye of Gibson is referring to Robert Gibson from the Rock and Roll Express's Lazy Eye. He has one eye that, you know, one eye he's paying attention to Ricky and the other one he's looking at the girls in the front row. Robert Gibson's eye. So the Eye of Gibson is that. And of course, I think we've talked about it before here on the show, Bix. I famously, notoriously, when I was 15 years old, asked Jim Cornette in 1995 Smoky Mountain Wrestling Fan Week, what's the deal with Robert Gibson's eye? Because it was something we were talking about all week. And he said he doesn't know and he's never been asked that question before and he can't believe that he answered it. So the Eye of Gibson. You have any thoughts on this?
You leave out the best part, which is that not knowing where this was going, he goes up, he picks you and says, oh, Brian always has good questions.
And then I ask him this, and everyone kind of loses it. And then I say, to push it over the top, which I could do sometimes, I go, yeah, he looks kind of like George Weingroff. And Cornette goes, no, the Weingroff's really fucked up. Because Weingroff's legally blind. George Weingroff is legally blind.
Yes.
Which is crazy when you think about the fact he was a wrestler who wrestled all over the place, but he was legally blind. So that was too much for Cornette. And then he walked it back, and that's what he said. I can't believe I answered that.
I was worried you wouldn't bring up the George Weingroff part, because that's actually my favorite part. That you're asking, it's not just that you're asking in the first place after he's inadvertently set you up. It's that you throw in the whatever it was. I remember it as he looks like George Weingroff or something.
Yes, that's what I said.
Or something. Yes, you left out the or something.
Oh, I thought you were saying or something. I didn't realize you were saying that.
I think you said or something.
Maybe. Probably. I was 15, so that is 21 years ago that happened. Yeah. So, the Eye of Gibson, now eligible each and every week for the top 10. Sorry, everyone else. We'll go through the entire list of write-ins shortly, but Eye of Gibson has made it. Number 6.
Hello, Bix.
Hi, Sue.
Or should I say goodbye?
Just now.
Mahatma Gandhi once said, there are no goodbyes for us. Wherever you are, you will always be in my heart. And Kate McCarthy said, there are no goodbyes in life. Only see you later. And I'll see you later in room 332 with Wee Willie Wilson.
From Florida.
He said goodbye. He went back to Florida. I never saw him again. Bix.
Yes?
Will you miss me? Will you write me? Will you send me a postcard?
Where do I send this postcard?
Send it down under. Care of Dan Leonard. He's my official biographer. He wrote Confessions of a Ring Rat. All about my years of ratting. And rooting, which Brian found out meant screwing here on the show. After all the Australian listeners wrote in and told him he was wrong about what he said.
So rooting is obviously more, it's going further than rogering, I would think.
I think, is rogering an Australian term?
I think it's British. It's close enough.
I think it's British too. Ask Alan Blackstock. He probably knows all about a good rogering. But Bix, I'll miss you. I still haven't received your Bix pick.
You'll be waiting longer for that.
Did you see on the Facebook page, I believe it's facebook.com/superpodcast, that there's a picture of me and Stone Cold Steve Austin?
This is not in the documentary?
I don't believe so. I can't get a copy. The filmmaker won't write back to me. She doesn't understand this is the most publicity I'll ever get.
There's That's a shame.
There's a Steve Austin picture. Me and Steve. Did you see what I was wearing on my shirt?
I'm looking for it right now.
A giant picture of Jerry the King Lawler's face.
Oh, I have seen that. Okay.
You've seen my pics. I haven't seen yours.
That is a bizarre shirt. Where did you get? Did you make that yourself, Sue?
I don't know. I know that Bob Barnett used to have shirts with Jerry Lawler's mugshot on it after he was arrested on false charges in 1993. He ruined the Survivor series by not being there.
Yeah, those nights didn't really make any sense once they weren't with a king.
It was Greg Valentine and Barry Horowitz and Jeff Gaylord who was never interested in me whatsoever. Terry Funk went home. His horse was sick.
That reminds me.
Are you impressed with my wrestling knowledge?
Yes, Sue. That reminds me. I was watching some AWF Warriors of Wrestling that I had never seen before on YouTube. And I discovered
my sympathies.
The tag team of Jeff Gaylord and the Warlord.
Oh, woohoo! They certainly were a tag team. I could tell you plenty about that. If they would only let me in their room. But
number,
they said that...
Is that number six?
Number six. Number Jeff six. Gaylord and the Warlord.
No, Sue the Shooter.
Sue the Shooter, number six.
Is Brian gone for the rest of the night?
Maybe I'll just keep doing the show with Sue the Shooter.
Number five, Sue.
Would that be the ultimate goodbye to Bix?
In a manner of speaking.
Will you say goodbye before the show's over if Sue the Shooter keeps talking to you?
What do you mean, will I say goodbye?
Number six, Sue the Shooter.
Where'd she go?
She's under the desk right now.
Don't make me call Susie about that.
Yeah, well, hopefully I think she's napping. But number six, Sue the Shooter. Number five.
Oh, I just realized. Oh. Same first name, kind of.
Kind of. She'll kill you. She's Colombian. She'll stab you if you make that comment. She's very good with a knife. Number five. Bix.
Hello, how are you?
Are you going to miss me? Bix, talk to me.
I'm just trying to think of a proper response. So how have you been doing, though? I'm curious how you're doing. You don't really give us many details about your own life.
I live my life in a world of darkness. With a synthesizer.
Also, weren't you in California?
I stayed indoors with the shades drawn, and I only drank milk. And I listened to lots of Kraftwerk.
Do you ever eat cold cereal for dinner, though?
Let's be honest, there's nothing wrong with that ever.
No, but in the context of everything else, it sounds like you may be a clinically depressed Black Scorpion.
I would love some Cookie Crisp right now. Bix.
Yes, Black Scorpion.
Please get me a dozen everything bagels with a pound of lox and some whitefish.
I was never a fan of lox.
I've heard that Brian recently became a fan of whitefish.
I used to like whitefish some. I kind of lost the taste for it.
I like that Brian said he couldn't do Denim Fritz because his voice. Somehow he got stuck in the middle of this.
That's because I'm trying to torture him.
Thank you.
Number five, the Black Scorpion.
Oh, I just realized who the Black Scorpion is.
Oh?
Rick Wakeman.
Very good. Rick Wakeman of the awful band Yes, I believe. Whereas my father once said when Yes came on the radio, no, and he turned it off. One of my favorite father moments. By the way, a couple people have done this, and I don't have anyone's name pulled up. A few people got in touch and said Global Wrestling is airing on ESPN Classic soon. You know, because it's hard to find, apparently. I'm going to give my father those times and dates and hope that he either watches it or DVRs it to watch it to get a review of wrestling on the air. It could be good or it could be a disaster where he actually decides that this is the point where he should take it seriously and really report on what he's seeing as opposed to just hearing things and just making up names and running with it like he did with the Slip House Boys and, of course, Shenandoah. The opponent of Kit Carson.
Which of those do you think is actually worse?
Well, what do you define as worse?
Further away from what was actually said on the air.
If they said Phantom X was Sebastian, there's at least an S at the beginning of the name. So Shenandoah and Sebastian share an S. If it was the California connection of Tatum and Price, and he somehow thought that meant Son and Fun, Son and Fun, I get. Slip House Boys, I'll go with them. Because, I mean, this just where does, you know, what is a Slip House? And why would that be what he thought it was? And just he accepted it. And he remembered it enough to tell me about it. He didn't tell me about it like a minute later. It was like, I talked to him a few days later and he still remembered. Oh, I got to tell you, I saw this thing. Son and Fun, the Slip House Boys. So that's my picks. What do you think, if you had to pick one?
I get your logic, but in a weird way, I think Shenandoah is worse. Because I can... The Slip House Boys are along the same theme. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, Son and Fun is.
Yes.
But the Slip House Boys, I don't know if it really is.
But it kind of is.
One of my goals with this show going forward is to find a way to popularize the Slip House Boys once again, because as we all know, they were incredibly popular early on and they have lost their steam. Once their actual identity was, we believe, determined, they lost all their popularity on the show. I mean, they still get votes. I think they got 3 votes this week. So they still get votes each week. But we need to come up with something. You know, Travis Heckle a while back did a wanted poster. And what happened was I had posted a picture on the Facebook page, of course, facebook.com/superpodcast, of Ted Turner shaking hands with a shirtless Mr. Wrestling 2. And I wrote, here are the original Slip House Boys. And then Travis took that and made a wanted poster with Ted's face and Mr. Wrestling 2's face. And I think for some reason, Mr. Wrestling 2 was wearing a cowboy hat in that picture. And it said, wanted the Slip House Boys, you know, please call the 605 Super Podcast. I need to find a way to make the Slip House Boys rise to prominence once again. You have no thoughts on this matter?
No, I muted myself.
Oh, well, there you go. So, number 5, the Black Scorpion. Number 4, disappointed Lance Russell. Lance, how do you feel that Bix is no longer going to be the co-host?
Ah!
You're friends with Lance Russell. You got to give him a call.
I do. I should.
Yeah, you should. Lance Russell is a national treasure. My pick for greatest wrestling commentator, announcer, host of all time. Hey, is Dave Brown eligible for the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame?
He's on the ballot.
Has he been on the ballot for several years?
Last 3 years, maybe.
Does he get any support?
I'd have to check exactly how much it was.
Do you think he should be in the Hall of Fame?
Yes.
Why? What is your argument for Dave Brown?
He's an all-time great wrestling announcer. He just happens to be overshadowed by being the longtime announcing partner of the greatest announcer of all time.
He's certainly overshadowed. I'm a fan of Dave Brown, but when you say all-time, one of the all-time greatest, I don't know. I don't know. I kind of need convincing there. Obviously, he takes over full-time in 89 as the host of the show. You know, it wasn't like he took over Memphis in its peak, although there were many good years. I mean, there's all the Eddie Gilbert stuff. There's all the Moondog stuff from 92. There's the WWF USWA feud. There's the Smoky Mountain USWA feud. There's Eddie Gilbert returning. There's many, many times of Eddie leaving and coming back.
Right.
So, I mean, there certainly are periods that were still really good. And they're better now looking back than probably people thought at the time because they were comparing it directly to things just a few years earlier with Lance Russell. But it's interesting. I'm a fan of Dave Brown. I don't know if I think he's a Hall of Famer.
He was also a more important piece of the puzzle than a lot of announcers were, though.
Well, that's – oh, look. I mean, if you're going to give someone points for – their importance, then yeah. I mean, there would be no Memphis wrestling on WMC Channel 5 probably without Dave Brown. So, I don't know. Plus, I think Jerry Jarrett should be in the Hall of Fame, and he's not in yet. And we've talked about that before.
Well, yeah.
I mean, that to me is the most egregious. How could Paul Heyman be in for being a booker and a promoter? And that's why he went in, because it was before his late run as a manager the last several years. But how could he be in for being a promoter and a booker and Jerry Jarrett's not in for being a booker and a promoter? I can't jive with that. That just doesn't make much sense to me.
I can explain it to you.
Do it.
Because he was able to manipulate wrestlers into being cool with him owing them money, but wrestlers hated Jerry Jarrett for not paying them enough money.
Yeah, Jerry Jarrett didn't pay them enough money, you could argue. And I say you could argue. I mean, I think it's a fact, although I'm sure Jerry Jarrett would say, well, you know, I was trying to keep my company afloat, you know, and I had to take my lion's share and Jerry Lawler was my partner. He got his share. And then, you know, the wrestlers got what was left over after everything else. So he didn't pay guys a lot and they resent him for it. Paulie actually drove several guys into bankruptcy, right? I mean, didn't Chris Candido have like $60,000 worth of charges for the company on his credit cards because Paul talked him into doing it? Didn't Shane Douglas have a very similar story too?
Yes, I believe the two of them both. I would think they did actually file bankruptcy. I don't know for a fact that they filed bankruptcy is the best way to put it, but I presume they did given the situation. Yes, that they had been putting the company flights on their personal credit cards as part of their pseudo office duties, and then all of a sudden Paul stopped paying them back.
Yes, I mean, Paul Heyman actually lied to people about money, didn't pay people on time, didn't, you know, drove people into bankruptcy. Jerry Jarrett just didn't pay people a lot, but it wasn't like it was a surprise. No one went to Memphis thinking I'm going to become a millionaire. Right.
Also with Heyman selling club ECW tickets at the last ECW arena show, knowing that the company was about to end and he was about to file bankruptcy, and all of the Geek Club ECW members would be screwed because they'd be low priority creditors.
See, I don't know too much about that because by that point I hated ECW, so I wasn't paying attention. Explain that. What was Club ECW exactly? Some kind of subscription program for tickets?
It was the thing where I don't remember if it was for my recollection is that it was just for the ECW arena. It was basically turning what Hat Guy, Sign Guy, Faith No More Guy, etc. had into like an official program where you could reserve blocks of front row seats and all that for, you know, months at a time in advance. And they were still selling those at the last ECW arena show, even though I'd have to check the date, but I want to say it was maybe in January. If it wasn't January, the earliest it would be was December, and they didn't run any shows after January.
Oh, jeez. Fucking Heyman. My one of my favorite, I shouldn't say favorite, but one of the full of shit Heyman moments that always drives me crazy. Can't say favorite. And I've had a few, including a couple of personal ones when I worked on Yama, which I'll get to at some point, where one thing happened with Paul and it certainly wouldn't have made Paul. It's not that it would have painted him in a bad light, but it wasn't anything to write home about or brag about. Quite the opposite. And all of a sudden, it ended up in the Observer completely. I'll just fucking say it. Paul Heyman was negotiating with Bob Myrowitz to come aboard Yama when we were working on it. It was me, Bob, and Peter Kauf working on it. And Paul was actively negotiating with Bob Myrowitz to come aboard because Paul had a friendship with Mike Tadros. And Mike Tadros had been a previous investor in the first version of Yama that was trying to get up off the ground a little bit, a year and a half or so before that. And Mike Tadros had been one to put Paul in the movie Rollerball, and he had recommended Paul and Bob talk, and Bob started talking to Paul and he thought he was interesting. And then we had a meeting, me, Bob, Peter Kauf, and Paul in Bob's brother's office. He's an attorney on Park Avenue South in Manhattan. And we and I always remember Paul Heyman walked into the meeting and he had one of those Bluetooth things in his ear. And he walked around to – there's three of us in the room, Bob, myself, and Peter Kauf. And he walked over to each one of us, and he shook our hand. He goes, Paul Heyman? Paul Heyman? Paul Heyman. Like, it's just – he said his name to everyone. It was – we all left like, what the hell was that about? Like, it was just so weird. And he kept his Bluetooth in the whole time, which was just – to me, it's one of my pet peeves. I hate when people walk around with the Bluetooth things alone. But when they sit in a meeting in it, it's just it's low class in my eyes. But – it didn't work out. Various things happened. I'll get into that when I do the Yama show one of these days. And it didn't work out. And Bob made the decision to move forward without Paul Heyman. And the next thing I read in the Observer, and I know who the source of this was Paul Heyman has chosen to turn down the offer from Bob Meyerowitz to work on Yama Pit Fighting. Well, I'm sure in the long term, that is absolutely the right move probably for Paul. That is certainly not the way I remember it happening at all. And I was intimately involved in just about everything involving that company. And I was I was talking to Bob about everything that was going on. And because I knew who Paul Heyman was, I was especially interested. And that isn't what happened yet. That is what ended up in the Wrestling Observer newsletter. We were never called and asked, hey, is this true, by Dave Meltzer, who doesn't really know me that well, but he knew Bob. Bob put him on a yada. Bob started Wrestling Observer Radio. So he knew Bob enough. He could have called and asked, but he didn't. And in the Observer, it said that Paul Heyman turned down Yama Pit Fighting, which was not at all how I remember that happening. And I have a pretty good memory for those of you who have been listening to this show. So, but what I was going to say, Bix, My full of shit Heyman moment that drives me crazy. He was on the Observer Radio once.
What are we talking about? Lance Russell?
Lance Russell. We're talking about the Hall of Fame. Lance Russell led to Dave Brown. Dave Brown led to the Hall of Fame discussion. Hall of Fame led to Jerry Jarrett. Jerry Jarrett led to Jerry Jarrett versus Paul Heyman as Hall of Famer. Paul Heyman was on the Observer Radio, I think, after Lou Albano died. And, you know, he does this thing. He's from Scarsdale, which is a suburb in Westchester County. But he tries to – sometimes I think he tries to come off like he's Mr. New York City and he knows everything about New York, which, you know, he isn't. And he made a claim on – he was talking about like CBGBs, and he just like definitively said CBGBs, which is very well known. It's the place the Sex Pistols played in New York. And it's like, you know, for someone who's supposed to be Mr. Alternative and Mr. Hip and have this knowledge of counterculture, that is such a stupid comment, just because it is like well known to anyone with any minimal knowledge of punk rock or the Sex Pistols, that not only did they not play New York and not play CBGBs, they didn't play the Northeast. Their tour was sabotaged by their manager. They were supposed to do Saturday Night Live, and he pulled them off Saturday Night Live. It was announced, next week, the Sex Pistols. Never happened. They flew into JFK, and then they flew right away down south, and they had their first show in Atlanta. And then they did this disastrous tour of the South. They did Atlanta. They did various shows in Texas. They did Memphis, which I always thought was one of the reasons why Wayne Ferris had on his tights punk rock Wayne Ferris, because it happened like, you know, he was wearing those tights, what, a year after the Sex Pistols. I always figured that's what it must have been. It must have been, you know, a weird reaction to punk rock coming to Memphis was, you know, Wayne punk rock Ferris. By the way, go look at Ferris and Latham as a tag team. There's nothing punk rock at all about them at all. But yeah, Heyman announced that the Sex Pistols played New York, which was just incredibly wrong. They broke up at the end of that tour. It was a disaster. Instead of them playing Saturday Night Live, that's the famous appearance of Elvis Costello, where he sang Radio Radio when he wasn't supposed to and got chased out of the studio by Lorne Michaels. But yeah, that's my that's one of those like Paul Heyman talking about something that he knows nothing about, but trying to sound like an authority. He doesn't know that the Sex Pistols never played CBGBs. So
I'm just sad that you didn't mention Malcolm McLaren's name, that you just kept calling him their manager.
Malcolm McLaren. I love Malcolm McLaren.
Malcolm McLaren is amazing.
He's dead now, but a stunning character, a wrestling type character.
Oh yeah.
That was in Rock and Roll. And if you're interested in any of the stuff I'm talking about, let me recommend a documentary I love called The Filth and the Fury by Julian Temple. It is one of the one of the best rock and roll documentaries ever, one of my favorite documentaries ever. And it accurately tells the story of the Sex Pistols against the backdrop of the social issues happening in England at that time. And it is just fantastic. I actually saw it in a theater when it came out at the Film Forum, I believe, in Lower Manhattan. So Filth and the Fury, check that out. Or if you want to read about it, there's a book called England's Dreaming by John Savage, which also touches on that. But number four, disappointed, disgusted, disgruntled, Lance Russell.
Apparently. Well, I do want to throw in, though, also about Malcolm McLaren. If you want to know about post-Sex Pistols Malcolm McLaren, definitely check out the book Rip It Up and Start Again.
Oh, fantastic book. Fantastic book. Yes.
Post-punk, and with him, it would, you know, it centers around his solo musical career as well as Adam and the Ants and Bow Wow Wow. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff in there, but that's the period in question for Malcolm McLaren. And boy, are there a lot of interesting things about him in that book.
Oh, yeah. You know, one of these days, I just got to start like a punk rock or a rock and roll podcast. I've been thinking about doing a baseball one, but maybe I got to do that just because I have such a institutional knowledge of all that stuff. And that's the world I've worked in. So I kind of know a little bit about it. But yeah, good book, Bix. Good book recommendation there. Rip it up and start again. Number four, Lance Russell. Number three, Gone Wrestling, Glenn Gozer.
Gone Wrestling.
I'm shocked that Glenn Gozer rose this high, just because we haven't really done anything fresh with him in a while. I know I keep saying I'm going to try to get someone on the show to talk about him, but we haven't done anything fresh with him. I think maybe it's time for another round of listener Glenn Gozer lyrics. So stay tuned, folks. Maybe on the Facebook page, facebook.com/superpodcast, you can put your Glenn Gozer going to wrestling lyrics, and we'll see how that turns out, because it always works out so well. That's number three, Glenn Gozer. Number two, Denim Fritz Von Erich. Bix, do you have anything to say to Denim Fritz this last time you're going to be sitting in for the top 10?
It's not my turn.
I am so proud that you played the kid and not Roddy. Play it again.
It's not my turn.
Can you play the whole thing? Because I can't get enough of it.
That's not my dad. That's not my dad.
That's not my dad.
That's not my dad. You say no. You mean it. When you say no to me.
No!
Say no harder. Mean it, doggone you.
No!
That's it. When you come up, you say no! No! That's not my dad!
And, you know, I'm trying to scratch in my brain here. Have you ever heard the phrase doggone you? I know doggone it.
I think I've heard doggone you.
You would think it would come from Bruno, not from Piper. Doggone you. I'll tell you. I don't know if you notice this, Bix. I was about to call you Fritz. I don't know if you notice this, Bix, but Denim Fritz got into a little bit of a feud this week with what I'm fairly certain is a fake account for Kenneth Slick Johnson. I don't think it's the real Slick. So on Twitter this week,
well, he's fairly busy right now with his litigation.
Is Slick in the lawsuit?
Yes.
I didn't even pick up on that.
Well, there's over 50 of them, so I can't blame you.
Well, real quick, just, you know, before we move forward with this. So there's this new lawsuit. It's various people using that same attorney who has been representing everyone, claiming that they have all these concussions and that WWE should be responsible for paying for it.
Well, it's not. This one's not just that.
Explain this lawsuit.
This one is not just the concussion stuff from before, but also being misclassified as independent contractors instead of employees. And also that being part of a racketeering scheme from WWE with Vince McMahon and WWE engaging in a racketeering scheme and the lawyer trying to use RICO laws against them and all that.
Well, that's ridiculous. Look, wrestlers are not independent contractors. I agree with that. And I think something needs to be done finally to rectify that. And, you know, it takes, you know... If one guy had the guts to do something, who was actively there and in a position to do something, it would cause something to happen. You know, we actually talk about this week, Bix, on the Jim Cornette Experience. Scott Williams comes on, and he, of course, is an author, I believe a friend of yours. Yeah. And he talks about the independent contract status and how this is all bullshit. So if you want to hear more about that, you can listen to that at the Jim Cornette Experience this week. But, you know, with this lawsuit – I mean, now that you say Slick sticks out to me is just, why is he there? I mean, he took bumps, but he didn't take that many bumps that, you know, he would have this. But the name that stuck out to me the most was Don Leo Jonathan.
Well, because he never had a contract. He was there for a few months in the early 70s.
In the early 70s? It wasn't even the same company. So, I mean, that was the one that struck me. It was like, well, how did Don Leo Jonathan get roped? He has to be like 85 years old now.
That's about right, yes.
Yeah, I mean, by all accounts, a legend, a Hall of Famer, one of the great guys in the ring, a giant who can move. You know, you never hear anyone say anything bad about him who worked with him. But I just don't know. You know, tell me if I'm wrong with my assessment. This lawyer is going to these conventions and going booth by booth and trying to rope people into this lawsuit.
He went to the last Legends of the Ring with Rene Dupree and was handing out his business card. Yes. And if you look at the list, a lot of them seem like your wrestling convention regulars. Demolition, Jimmy Snuka, Road Warrior.
Jimmy Snuka, isn't that something?
Is it really surprising, though?
I don't know. Was he at the last convention?
No, but still. I mean, but I would think that would be more about looping that in with his whole incompetence thing.
Yeah. That is interesting. He's incompetent, but he's going to wrestling conventions and he's going to be part of this lawsuit.
I don't know if he's been going to conventions. I mean, he is booked for WrestleCon next year.
Yes. Yes, which is easily the most tasteless one since the Invader number one was booked for something. But as you pointed out previously, that was a vendor booth. It wasn't actual convention booking him. Let me read a couple of Denim Fritz things real quick.
Oh, boy.
I just used Gino's powder to soothe my chafed taint.
To what? Did you just say chafed taint?
Gino is screaming that I just wasted $5,000. Where is he buying his powder?
Well, it does have topical analgesic properties. Properties?
Gino just said he introduced his girl to Dirty Sanchez. I have no idea he was still working. I booked him in the prelims back in 78. Just got done telling Iceman his bookings for the week. He said word. Of course I'm using words. What does he want? Pictures? Smoke signals? True story. My boy Mike once saved the turtle from getting run over by a car. See, it's just, this guy is great. I don't know who you are, but you are a great man and you do a great job. And boy, you're picking up followers. You got almost 700 followers now.
Wow.
Denim Fritz von Erich. Hey, Denim Fritz, do me a favor, though, because you're the official Denim Fritz of the show. In your Twitter handle, where it says father of five future NWA champions making denim sexy again, you know, mark in there somehow, notate that you're aligned with at 605 pod, just so it's official. But please get a chance to do that. But Denim Fritz, number two on this week's top 10 picks. Number one, Mark Guleen of the House of Guleen.
Your mamba!
Damn it. Well, might as well. I went to press T and my finger slipped and hit Y.
This man is totally awesome.
What else you got? What else is available in the soundboard from Mark Guleen?
Totally awesome. Your Mamba, the Jungle Savage.
Let's see. Was there anything else?
I will tell you more about him later.
You will see him in the coming weeks, right?
You will see him in the coming week. I have a surprise coming for you.
Well, of course, this is the first week, Bix, that Mark Guleen has not been the champion in well over 2 months. It could be 3 months. I got to double check the dates. So Mark Guleen is number one, which means next week he will face the winner of Orgasmic Larry Nelson versus the Nature Goy, Ric Flair, which we'll talk about that match in a second here. But do you think Guleen's going to regain the title?
I think he's going to, I think he could maybe if, I mean, it depends on who he's facing. If he, Larry Nelson would be close. I think if the Nature Boy somehow pulled off Nature Goy pulled off the upset, then I think Gulen would somehow destroy him.
Okay. I think that's a very I think I agree with you, actually. But let's go to some of the fantasy booking from the listeners here of the Super Podcast. Actually, you know what? Before we do that, I'm going to go through the write-in votes now that I think about it. First of all, other people receiving votes from the regular candidates: the Hangman Bruce Pobanz, Fake Stan Lane, Coleslaw Jim Duggan, Misnomer Chris Adams, Judo Joe Black, the Mad Dog Boyd, Tiny URL Hebner, Demolition Hux and Blast, Wee Willie Wilson from Florida, the Slip House Boys, Hobo Brazil, Akeem Bixenspan, and Sex Appeal Ronnie Steele. What do we do with Akeem Bixenspan, Bix? Should he remain eligible?
Let me ask for some advice.
Yeah, are you
That wasn't very helpful.
I was going to say, are you taking him with you? Is Akeem going with you for your for your future pursuits?
We'll have to discuss that.
Okay, so maybe or maybe not, but here are this week's write-in votes.
It's not like he's ever had a chance at a title shot, though. So
he never has. Of course, he did make a brief run recently into the top 10, but he's back out of the top 10, and he only received a few votes this week. The write-in votes, of course, we do this. It's been a little over a month since the last time. That doesn't mean it's going to be next week, so we'll probably do it again probably a month's time. Write-in votes, it's a way to introduce some new characters into the top 10, or and also just let the listeners have their say. Let me say to start, I am shocked that Will Sweetie did not vote for the Stormtrooper. It's the first time he hasn't, so Will, check in, let us know you're okay. Here are the write-in votes. The Dolphin, of course, from the artwork that Travis Eichel did of me fighting a dolphin. I believe it was actually a fake shark I took the picture with that was based on. But for those of you who want to see what I look like, you can go to facebook.com/superpodcast. You can see both a picture of me in Hawaii with a man dressed like a shark holding a surfboard. And of course, Travis Heckle's drawing of that, which it turns into Brian Last versus the Dolphin. The Eye of Gibson, naturally. And of course, he made the top 10. He's now a candidate going forward. The Rock and Rats Express. The Mullet of Morton, who has been the most vocal on Twitter about trying to get into the top 10. I'm sorry to say this, you just missed out. Literally one or two votes away from the top 10. So maybe next time, Mullet of Morton. Ramadan Harris. That one took a second for me. I wrote it down. And I didn't even realize it. That is fantastic. That is fantastic. Ramadan Harris. Denim Mike Pence. Mike Lano's Turban. Baby Fritz Von Erich. Roland Trump. I think you meant Ronald Trump, if we're talking about what we talked about last week. I don't know who Roland Trump would be.
Yes, Ronald Trump, a.k.a. Hugh Hart.
Yes, Roland Trump is a.k.a. Roland Alexander, I guess. I don't know. Denim David Bixenspan, two votes. Dr. Mike Lano, two votes. You know, I've been debating whether Mike Lano should be added to the Super Universe candidates because he's kind of in that Hangman Bruce Pobanz category.
I have an idea. Mm-hmm. Perhaps maybe no Dr. Mike Lano in the Super Universe, but maybe the wrestling dentist who beat Hogan for the title can be in the Super Universe.
Yeah, I just feel like everyone's going to hate writing that down when they have to vote, but we got to do something. I mean, he's certainly the story. Everyone's been going crazy about the Michael Lano stories. And of course, for all of you who have asked and all of you who have heard about it here on the show, on the Facebook page is the photo of Dr. Mike Lano with Jenna Jameson, which the consensus seems to be is a photoshopped photo. But if you want to see this, we talked about it. There it is. It's on the Facebook page.
Okay, wait a second. Not to get further sidetracked again, but we did talk about this a little bit off air. I was re-examining it. I'm not sure either way.
You're talking about whether it's photoshopped or not.
Yeah. It looks very peculiar.
It looks peculiar. There are things you pointed out about the position of her head. The fact that, as Scott Cornish said, a friend of the show, that is the most amount of clothes I've ever seen Jenna Jameson wear.
Right. The torso doesn't quite match. The positioning of the head and which direction it's looking towards.
Bob Barnett, out of whack. I'm sorry. Bob Barnett points out that her head looks like a pin and his head is gigantic. I've always thought
it looks like he's standing closer to the camera.
I've always thought that it was kind of like the way I pictured it. And again, it could be a Photoshop and I could be wrong. And I recognize that I'm probably wrong. He actually did run into her. She actually was dressed, you know, not like a stripper or anything. He said, "Hey, can I have a picture with you?" And she put her arm around him for a picture. And right as the camera's about to go off, for whatever reason, he leans into the camera to do something. And that's why he's leaning closer to the camera with this crazed look in his eyes, like, look into my eyes, you know? But then again, it could just be the worst Photoshop ever from, what, 98, 97, 98, I guess.
Well, actually, that's what makes me think it could be real, is that I don't see Mike Lano being that good, relatively speaking, at 1998 Photoshop.
No, he would have had to have someone do it for him, I think.
The other thing that I think is a red flag is if you try to zoom it in, and yes, we're zooming in on an old low-resolution photo, some of the shadows, especially around her, look like they're like airbrushed in using like the spray paint tool in Paint.
Well, this photo is on the Facebook page. Listeners, please chime in. Do you think it's Photoshopped or not? And let's do it. Maybe an up and down yay or nay vote. Should Dr. Mike Lano be included in the Super Universe top 10? That will be, you know what, this week when I do the top 10, and again, what I did this week, and I'm going to do it again next week. I'm saying this week and next week, I'm confusing everyone. But what I've done previously, and I'm going to do it again, is the voting for the championship match will be a separate post the next day. So that'll be Friday. Thursday is the actual top 10 voting. And in the top 10 voting, you can vote for three candidates for the top 10, but also you could vote for up or down, yay or nay. Should Dr. Mike Lano be included in the top 10? And if you vote yes, that means starting next week, he would be eligible to be voted on for the top 10. So back to the write-in votes, Bix. Bummy Rogers, two votes for Troy Graham's ghost. Poopstain Patterson, NWO Larry Nelson, STD Jones, and I believe one person noted that his finishing maneuver was the chlamydia claw. Whole wheat bread, David Bix. Hangman Bruce Poopants. Jim Cornette's tennis racket. Barry Bang Bang, controversial. Big Van Oy Vader, the Jewish mastodon. Vince Russo's collie. I don't get that one. Buddy Hack Roberts.
No, I get that one.
What is that one?
From last week's Cornette show.
Oh.
That's your right. Show. Should I let you explain?
Yeah.
I listened to this. You were there, and I actually remember it better.
Please explain.
So, I guess Vince Russo and his further efforts to try to do a podcast or confrontation or something with Cornette said it could be for charity if there was money or income or something, and said something like, it can go to that charity that helps out wrestlers, Collie.
Oh, that's right. Collie Flap. Yes, that's right. That's right. Vince Russo's Collie. Now I get it.
that's, of course, the syndicated name of the version of Lassie that included Vince Russo as Timmy.
Yeah.
Vince Russo. How many people are actually going to get that show? You got that joke.
I think a lot of people, because Lassie was on Nickelodeon every day in the 80s.
No, but people aren't going to know about the syndicated title of Jeff's Collie now that I've given it away.
That's true. But it gives you something to look for. And unfortunately, I think that may mean that I have to find it and put it in the video playlist now that it's been mentioned here on the show. But back to the list. Black Scorpion Synthesizer. Soft Rock Cowboy Bill Watts. That's the second time that he's been voted into this.
I don't even get what some of these are.
I don't understand this one either. Soft Rock Cowboy Bill Watts. What am I missing?
Soft Rock. No, I don't know.
Does Bill Watts listen to REO Speedwagon? I don't understand. Explain yourself. Soft Rock Cowboy Bill Watts.
Yeah, people, listeners, please. If any of these haven't been mentioned on the show, you may have to give a character biography.
Yeah.
Unless it's self-explanatory, like Ramadan Harris.
Foot Von Erich. Carrie Von Erich's prosthetic foot.
Aww.
Roly Poly Oli, which I believe is the Twitter account for Oli Anderson, who's also been fighting to get into the top 10. He got one vote. The Piss Boys got a vote. The Rat and Roll Express. Now, earlier I said the Rock and Rats Express. I didn't combine them. Those are two separate teams. The Rock and Rats Express and the Rat and Roll Express. Randy X. Randy Hales in the Nation of Domination. The Lano Lawsuit.
That's not a character.
The Notorious B.I.X.
Okay, that's good. We love you all, but please try. Some of these things don't exactly fit the motif.
And the last one is beer salesman Michelob Vachon.
Wait, what?
The beer salesman Michelob Vachon. See, that's funny. I'm sorry, that's funny.
It's funny, but I can't even figure out why it's funny.
It's just Michelob Vachon. Well.
See, I was thinking if you were going for the play on words, maybe it would be Baron Michelob Six Luna.
See, that would work too. That would work too. I've been drinking beer for years. I don't think I've ever actually had a Michelob. I don't know if I've ever seen a Michelob. I must have, but I can't even think of what the bottle looks like. I've never had a Michelob.
I'm trying to think if I've ever even seen one in a store around here.
Yeah. I'll see Schlitz.
Is there a regional Michelob thing?
I don't know. I literally don't know. So, but anyway, we'll look into the status of Michelob. Listener fantasy booking for the championship match, Nature Goy, Ric Flair versus our champion, Larry Nelson, Orgasmic Larry Nelson. I want to say, everyone, you submit great stuff. Obviously, I can't get to everything on the show, but I do really appreciate it. And I know that the other listeners enjoy reading everyone's fantasy booking. So I'm going to go a select few here. I'm going to do Gareth Cross. The Nature Goy wins with the figure four skin lock. Glenn Braggett.
Wait. I gotta say this too, because you know we have the Nature Goy Ric Flair Twitter account, and as much as we love all these Twitter accounts, I don't think the Nature Goy Twitter quite understands what a Goy is. Whereas the person who came up with the figure four skin lock clearly understands what a Goy is and what being a Goy may entail.
Well, I don't know if you noticed. I told Travis Heckel that I thought this would be a good idea. Right now, currently, the banner on the Facebook page, I'm not sure if it'll be the banner by the time you listen to it at home. It is the Nature Goy Ric Flair. It is Ric Flair with a tallis and a menorah and a yarmulke holding Jessica Simpson, a shiksa, in his arms.
Is it a denim yarmulke? I looked earlier and I can't remember.
I don't think it is, but if it is, that just means Travis is even more of a genius than I thought. But that's the Nature Goy Ric Flair artwork that's currently up. And by the way, Travis recently did some classic artwork that's going to be going up in the next few days. I'm going to roll them out one at a time. He went back and listened to all the early episodes. So we have fresh artwork for Hangman and Stop the Murder and all those early classics from the early episodes. So those will be going up.
Please tell me there's one for Dr. Ernie's dog. Or no, because we can't do better than the original photo.
I don't think there's anything new as of now. And I also don't know if we could ever do better than not just the original photo of the dog, but Travis's original artwork that he did for her colon cleaning business. Let's go back to the fantasy booking. Glenn Braggett. Nelson is no 1 week wonder. The Goy took a trip of a different type to Larryland and was snowed in without leaving his showboat presidential suite. Your winner by forfeit, Orgasmic Larry Nelson. Rod Trongard throws down his headset in disgust, and Lord Bleers demands that Stanley Blackburn look into what happened to the Nature Goy. Rocky Mountain Thunder claims he was nowhere near the Goy's suite. That's good. Timothy Weckler, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Timothy Weckler. Nature Goy wins with a roll-up after interference from Gentile man Chris Adams. Transitional champion Orgasmic Larry Nelson called for a rematch, stating that Nature Goy's victory was not kosher. That's very good. Gentile man Chris Adams. I like that. Steve Cordes. Larry Nelson annihilates the Nature Goy, looking to prove his victory last week was no fluke. Finish comes when Orgasmic Larry hits the white powder bomb. his variation of the Blue Thunder Bomb. It's good. Paul Whitney, the match ends right at sundown when the Nature Goy has to stop working to observe the Sabbath. Call the medic, Orgasmic Larry Nelson wins. Gregorio Miron, or Miron, not sure. Let me know, Greg. Gregorio, excuse me. The Nature Goy, after the Oy Vey chops gave Galeen various crushed ribs, the Nature Goy decides to settle the match on a dreidel spin. Hits none and wins. Why none? Call Bruno. That's pretty good.
I just thought of a good twist for the Nature Goy character that can kind of let the Twitter version have his cake and eat it too.
What's that?
Make him a Seventh-day Adventist.
Oh, come on.
Think about it. He gets to kind of do Jewish things while still being a Goy.
See, the way I picture the Nature Goy is he is totally Goyim, but it's kind of like the way I picture it is it's Ric Flair dealing with his Jewish in-laws when he was married to his Jewish wife. Okay. So it's Ric Flair being Ric Flair, you know, wearing the yarmulke and, you know, sitting at the table and reading the questions and, you know, doing all that stuff. That's kind of the way I pictured it.
He's like the Goyim uncle who looks really uncomfortable wearing the yarmulke.
Yes. I mean, imagine the yarmulke on that big blonde head of hair. So, yes, that's kind of what it is. A few more here, Bix. Lance Lumley. Nelson retains. The Nature Goy comes to the ring with the First Lady of Wrestling, Sue the Shooter. During the match, the Goy throws white powder at Nelson but misses. Nelson falls to the mat, snorts it, and gives his famous guy, which is his version of hulking up that makes the crowd go crazy, and pins him with his finisher, Scotch on the Rocks, the original rock bottom, to retain the title. Afterwards, Nelson announces his new stable featuring his twin sons, Matthew and Gunner. Russell Breeding. Larry Nelson wins by spinning the devil dreidel, which causes the Nature Goy to drop his foreign object of a potato knish. Larry orgasms loud by screaming medic and schoolboys the Nature Goy, for the win.
See, because he's a Goyim, though, he would probably call it a knish.
Yeah. Who was it? Years ago, Michelle Bachmann was giving a speech somewhere, and she's like, as the Jewish people say, L'chaim.
Whatever. Yes, that was right.
Yeah, I was like, what? You know, it was so ridiculous that I thought it was the funniest thing.
I mean, isn't the whole, like, thing, like, if you're not Jewish, isn't it, like, isn't, like, not saying she's an anti-Semite, but, like, isn't it a whole thing to make fun of Jews with, like, and all that?
Yeah.
So how do you not realize it's L'chaim?
It's L'chaim. That was one of those great Michelle Bachmann moments. But anyway, one more here, Bix, and I think this is my favorite one for the week for its simplicity. Eddie Saivarth, Orgasmic Larry Nelson over Nature Goy, they just have a really good match. And that's our fantasy booking for the week. I think that's my favorite one ever, actually. But the votes are in. The votes are tallied. The winner of the match and still 605 Super Universe champion is none other than Orgasmic Larry Nelson.
No,
Do you have the short form version?
No.
And let's do them both together.
Well, we
still don't have medic. I'm gonna have to work on that. But that means next week, the biggest rematch, the biggest match in the history of the Super Universe by far. Orgasmic Larry Nelson defending his title against a resurgent Mark Galeen. It's Mark Galeen getting a rematch. He went right to number one on the top 10. Big choice for you guys out there. Larry Nelson's popularity has only been growing and growing and growing. There's been a lot of really great Travis Echo artwork. Mark Galeen, I'm going to probably get a couple guests on the show hopefully soon to talk about Mark Galeen a little further just to refresh the conversation. But next week's going to be a tough one, Bix. Mark Galeen trying to get the title back from the man who just defeated him last week, Orgasmic Larry Nelson. And with that, the top 10 is over for this week, and boy, we took a lot of side roads on that one.
Well, for old time's sake.
Well, now we got some follow-ups, Bix, and the first one is a mistake I made last week, which ended up being quite humorous. When I wrote the description of the show and I sent it to Bix, I noticed nothing was egregiously wrong, but I also didn't realize there was an autocorrect that corrected Starcade 83, which became Starched 83. So multiple people jumped on that within minutes of the show going up and said, what's Starched 83? So that was a mistake. It was an autocorrect nightmare. It goes,
I gotta say.
Yeah.
I'm not crazy about having autocorrect on a computer.
I didn't even notice it was on. I mean, that's the first time I've really had this issue. And
really?
I never really have a problem. On my phone, it's a problem. But on the computer, I don't really have the issue. But Starched.
Because it turns it into a real word, though. If you haven't added whatever to your dictionary, I mean, that means your spell check's not going to catch it.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'll turn it off. But Starched 83.
Or just add it to your dictionary.
Yeah. Well, Starched 83 at this point now is going to be the super card when we do the big super card for the Super Universe. It'll be Starched 83. I have a bunch of follow-ups here to go through. One is on the topic of the Nature Goy. I want to read this. Charles Chase, a frequent contributor here to the show.
Very alliterative name.
Charles Chase. I know it is. For the Nature Goy, Ric Flair, he's a Knish stealing, oi! Bargain dealing, Uber riding, menorah lighting, son of a mensch. Who wants to take a ride on the kosher coaster? So,
Wait, riding an Uber is a Jewish thing?
I don't think so. I've never thought of it as an inherently Jewish thing. I've never thought of it in any way as being a Jewish thing, but we'll go with it for now. If you're a Jewish listener, I know we have a lot of them. Do you use Uber? Let us know. Chime in.
Well, do you use Uber more than your Gentile friends?
Yes, more than the Gentiles, more than Gentile man Chris Adams. Do you use Uber? Let us know. But Charles, you made me laugh again. Good job there. A few letters here and a few other things and follow-ups from last week, Bix. This one came in about Dick the Bruiser. Hello, my name is Mark Barnes from Indianapolis, and I wanted to share a Dick the Bruiser story with you. My mom told me that when she had my sister, she was in a room with 6 to 8 other women who had just given birth. The lady next to her was Dick the Bruiser's wife. My mom said when she was in the room, he was the nicest guy who even held my sister. But my mom was confused because when he would leave the room, he was in character, yelling at people in the hallway. My mom was and still is not a wrestling fan. So this was confusing to her. Just wanted to share this and say the podcast is great and fuck those guys. Hey, thanks, Mark. That's pretty funny. Dick the Bruiser's like gentle, you know, father Dick the Bruiser. As soon as he goes in the hallway, it's like a movie. Like, you know, the cameramen are waiting there. The reporters are waiting there. And he just right away goes back into the Dick the Bruiser act. I love that, Bix. Dustin. Yeah.
Well, you know, in the middle of all this, I'm just trying to think of other characters that could complement the Nature Goy and Gentile Man Chris Adams, and I'm trying to I was trying to think of a way to work in Shegetz. You don't know what Shegetz is?
I don't know how you're gonna work it in.
Well, that's it's the male equivalent of Shiksa.
Yeah.
And the only thing I could think of was like Honky Tonk Man doing the Shegetz rattle and roll. Yeah, it doesn't really work.
No, because it's honky and he has no relationship with the Nature Goy. How do we get Gelt involved? That's the one I want involved somehow.
World Championship Gelt.
That's a good idea. Like a championship belt, like a chocolate championship belt.
If we got Dave Milliken working with a chocolatier, I wonder how much that would cost.
Yeah, I wonder how much weight he would gain. But Dustin Lafferty pointed out, yes, Bix was right. Nell Carter was on Give Me a Break. So there you go with that. Mike Mills had something to say. Mike Mills, of course, the host of the Booking the Territories podcast. I've been on that a few times. Good guy. He's from New Orleans, Bix. So I like talking to him because – you know, you and I can opine and talk to other people who are fans of Mid-South Wrestling, but when you talk to someone who's actually there, you always get a different perspective and an interesting perspective. You know, he told me that Junkyard Dog was as popular as ever, you know, to him and his friends when Junkyard Dog left in 1984. So you get an interesting perspective, and that's kind of the topic here of this article. Or, excuse me, this letter. Great discussion on the 605 pod this week about the Mid-South Territory dying and how the territory was dead after 86, 87. As a point of note, the region changed drastically at that time. The Saints, the New Orleans Saints, finally started winning games. And while I know football and wrestling are different, when the Saints got hot, most of Louisiana and Mississippi completely dove into Saints football. As a wrestling fan and a football fan, I found myself completely content during that time period to invest my time into WWF's weekly show and the Saturday Night 605 show. Local wrestling shows just weren't even equivalent to watching those shows on TV and attending Saints games. The market and the territory for Mid-South just evaporated, sadly. Just my thoughts from last week's episode that I thoroughly enjoyed. So that's an interesting perspective. You know, you always hear about the oil crunch. You never think about the fact that the one team down there got good.
I'm just trying to figure out the best way to process this. So, yes, a team becoming good. How long have the Saints been around at that point?
I'm the wrong person to ask that question to. I'm not sure. I'll look that up right now. What were you thinking?
What do you mean? I'm just curious, like, because he says, oh, they finally got good. So were they fairly new at that point, or?
Let's see here. New Orleans Saints, Wikipedia. Wikipedia is never wrong. Oh, no, established 1966. First season, 1967.
When did the Jazz leave New Orleans?
The New Orleans Jazz? They went to Utah. I'm not sure what year. Let's see.
What a name. What I can't. Nowadays they would change the name, right?
Yeah, so that you didn't have the Utah Jazz? Yeah, I think so. That's the most ridiculous misnomer.
All of those great Utah Jazz musicians like Donny Osmond.
Oh, the New Orleans Jazz? Wow, this I didn't realize it was such a short period of time. They only existed from 74 to 79. Hmm. And then in 79 they went to Utah. Very interesting.
I'm trying to figure out if it would be better if they were the Salt Lake City Jazz. Like, is it which is more horrifying, the Utah Jazz or the Salt Lake City Jazz?
I don't know about horrifying, but I think Utah works better than Salt Lake City, just in terms of rolls off the tongue.
Yes, I agree. But which sounds less jazzy?
Well, you know, I mean, you're getting a real run for your money with this one. They both sound completely unjazzy.
Wait, so they move? I'm trying to remember what year did the Mormon Church start allowing black people?
It may have been around that time.
That's interesting, right? Then, isn't it?
Yeah.
That the Jazz.
Well, you know, they were hoping to get Karl Malone. That's what it's all about. But yeah, thank you, Mike, for chiming in with that, a good letter there. We talked a lot last week about bad managers, Bix, and we tried to think of many bad managers, and lots of other people had a lot to say, so I'm going to read through some of these, and it'll refresh both you and I, and we'll have something to say about it. One is, last week I accidentally said Jonathan Holiday when I was talking about Jim Holiday from Florida. Let me point that out. Jim Holiday from Florida, and again, bad manager, that's all in the eye of the beholder. It's whatever perspective you have on the matter.
I gotta say, anytime you say from Florida without saying it as from Florida or whatever, I'm disappointed.
My goal is that someone will be out there with their friends who listens to the show, and it'll come up and they'll just drop into that voice and say from Florida, and the people will be like, what the hell are you doing? Like, why are you doing that? Various people recommended the same managers, so I'm not going to hit everyone's name because a lot of people recommend the same people, but a few people here. Daniel Nelwert, Harley Race.
I wouldn't say so.
I wouldn't say so now, but I would have said so then.
He wasn't good. He wasn't especially good, but I think he was fine for what he was doing. I mean, he wasn't especially good with Luger, no. With Vader, I thought he was effective.
Ronnie P. Gossett? I don't know if I would.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, I thought he was actually pretty good.
Ronnie P. Gossett is awesome.
Yeah, so I wouldn't put him there. The next one is a winner. Johnny Valiant. Yeah, he's horrible. He's a horrible manager.
Yeah.
I just don't get him at all. I thought his promos were just bizarre and made no sense.
There is one great Johnny Valiant moment. Have you ever seen this? It's at the Spectrum. The spoiler is I think he's just wrestling some low prelim guy.
Okay, so probably 84?
84, 85, yeah. And the ring announcer, and remember, it's Philly, so you probably have like 3 or 4 different ring announcers that night because of weird athletic commission politics. The ring announcer has no idea who the spoiler is and just forgets his name. And as the spoiler just starts menacing the ring announcer and then beating up the prelim guy, Valiant just keeps going, "What's his name? What's his name?"
I believe the Spectrum is the same place where we played on the show a while back. Mel Phillips forgot the name of the junkyard dog.
The junkyard.
In the middle of the name. It's not like you forgot the name. You forgot the name in the middle of the name. Right. So something in the water there in Philly.
That's I've always been fascinated by that, watching the Spectrum shows, all the weird, like, if you don't know what it is, it's probably even weirder that all of the Pennsylvania Athletic Commission politics that leads to there being like 3 or 4 different ring announcers, all these different referees you don't normally see. You know what I mean? Like, there'll be shows where, I'm trying to think, you'd have like Mel Phillips, Gary Gapetta, Frank Talent of the Athletic Commission, all doing ring announcing. Who else? I think I think Victor Quinones as a referee. Just all sorts of like people there because of the Athletic Commission, other weird like political stuff that you wouldn't see elsewhere.
Yeah, this sums it up pretty good. Kim Chi. I don't know if you call Kim Chi a manager.
He's not a manager. He's a handler.
Yeah.
Kim Diamond. I mean, Kamala had different managers when he had Kim Chi.
Yeah, he had Skandar Akbar. He had the Wizard. He had Fuji, right, at one time.
Who was his last one? Who was his last? Harvey Whippleman?
Harvey Whippleman, J.J. Dillon. And by the way, a lot of people said Harvey Whippleman. I agree. Harvey Whippleman's terrible.
Well, wait. Are we considering Harvey Whippleman and Downtown Bruno two different entities?
Yes.
Okay.
Do you think Downtown Bruno is good?
In a way that only worked in Memphis and Continental, yes.
Okay, I'm not the biggest Downtown Bruno fan, but certainly Harvey Whippleman is the top of the list. Diamond Dallas Page, I agree. I never liked Dallas Page as a manager at all. What do you think?
Good God.
Yeah. It's the same thing over and over again. He's bigger than any of the wrestlers. The Jackal?
No, because Don Callis was a good promo.
And the Baron. Baron Von Raschke and his goof friends, the Baron.
Well, he didn't really do anything. He was gone in a few weeks.
One name that a lot of people brought up, Seth Hansen did. I believe Scott Cornish did. Mr. JR from the Championship Wrestling from Georgia days.
I get a kick out of Mr. JR, part because of his promos, part because no one has any clue who he is.
That's what it is. His promos are entertaining in a sense, especially when you think about, I've never heard any peep out of anyone of who he was or why he was there. Right?
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to dig into that and see if I can find out about Mr. JR.
Yeah, people have been on this case for a while. No one knows who he is.
Mr. Donnie. That's another good pick.
How dare you? Whoever picked Mr. Donnie.
I'll tell you who. Jay Doherty.
Please justify to me how Tommy Rich's alleged procurer is a bad manager during the period where Tommy Rich is hanging out with a biker gang. That's awesome. He's with this emaciated biker dude who I believe has found Christ in recent years.
Oh, good for him.
He looks like a cleaned up Mr. Donnie now. Imagine that.
Well, we'll talk more about that. Travis Heckle, I think, actually hit on a really, really good one here, just in terms of not a good manager. Mickey Poole. For those of you who don't know, Mickey Poole was Lawler's manager in like 76, 77. He also ended up managing the original Samoans, Tio and Tapu. He wasn't good, though. He didn't do anything. Remember, Lawler went through like a string of managers, and even early Jimmy Hart.
Yes.
Where they just didn't do it. They were just there to be his guy, but they didn't actually do anything or cut good promos or anything.
Wasn't Mickey Poole brought in with the idea of him eventually losing his hair, though? Wasn't that the only reason he was there?
I know that's what happened. I don't know if that's why he was brought in.
But I know they called him a manager. I think of him as more of just like a lackey.
I understand where you're coming from, but I think you have to consider him a manager. Because if he wasn't so inept, or if he had something to do, you would think of him as a manager. But because he's standing by, he's called his manager, and then he stands by Lawler while Lawler does everything. And he acts like a lackey in a sense, but I mean, that's Lawler. Lawler treats his managers like lackey, other than Sam Bass.
If he wasn't called a manager, though, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
No, but I mean, he was called a manager. So, yeah. Apparently, Travis wrote here, he showed up in the USWA after being gone since 77 for an angle, but then disappeared. I think he helped Tommy Rich beat Jerry Lawler. I don't remember that at all. I got to look into that.
They had a lot of weird stuff where they'd bring people back like that. Yeah, remember when Brian Christopher brought in Spaceman Frank Hickey?
Yeah, summer of 93. Summer of 93 brought in Spaceman. And you know what else? On the list of managers here, I'm going to bring this up when I talked to Jeannie Clark here on the show, which should be coming up pretty soon. I didn't realize, remember Nanny Simpson? Tony Adams, when she was brought in to be Brian Christopher's nanny, and then Chris Adams came in. That role was offered to Jeannie Clark. Jerry Jarrett called Jeannie Clark and asked her to be Nanny Simpson before Tony Adams was brought in for that role, which is really interesting. So, but again, I don't know if you would consider Nanny Simpson a manager there. But on the topic of Memphis managers, Reggie B. Fine, a lot of people chimed in with him.
How dare they?
Are you feigning outrage, or do you legitimately think that's ridiculous?
I don't think he's necessarily good, but I'm too entertained by him to outright call him bad. One of the worst.
Okay. A lot of people thought so. Here's Greg Dufour. Once again, lost his Johnny Valiant. Was hard. He couldn't put a sentence together. Lousy manager, David McKenzie, who I talk to all the time. Lousy manager, Eddie Sharkey in Tony Condello's Four West promotion in Winnipeg in 1986. One of his wrestling school proteges was supposed to act as the manager for the CKY TV Channel 7 Winnipeg tapings in June of 1986, but missed a ride up from Minneapolis. So Sharkey himself turned heel manager for the summer. I had to work color commentary for those tapings and could not believe how lousy Eddie was. Like Bockwinkel loved to say, those who can't teach.
Who was it that sent in the...
David McKenzie. David McKenzie.
Okay. Because I was trying to think if I had ever seen any of his stuff calling that. Because I know of Joe Aiello, because he's the guy I always associate with calling the Winnipeg stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't think I've ever seen the stuff from then.
Yeah, I don't know if I have either. A few others here. Ray Soriano, in regards to the worst managers, how about Frenchie Martin? Yeah, ding, ding, ding. Horrible manager.
But he wasn't really there to be a manager. I think he was more there to do his job for the syndicated shows in French and Spanish to be the interviewer.
But you can't take that away from it, Bix.
No,
he was a manager.
Not, but
he was a shitty manager.
Yeah, and they put him with Dino Bravo,
who was a shitty wrestler. So I mean,
exactly.
it was a winning combination. And Dino Bravo wasn't always shitty, but when he got really big on steroids and bleached his hair, he was really shitty. Frenchie Martin, the Wizard.
Which the Wizard?
Curtis Iaquea, I believe. I mean, he was a great promo, but Johnny Polo. I don't think Johnny Polo was bad.
Come on.
I think Johnny Polo was good. Sir William, which was Dundee managing Steven Regal. I mean, that's a complicated one. He kind of did what he was supposed to do.
Although he was also booking.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm going to come back to that one. Clarence Mason. Yeah, I would put that on the list. Scott Cornish has a bunch of here. Ronnie Lotz. That's a good one. Nurse Cratchit. I forgot about that one. Boy, Memphis really has the winners, Biggs. Burt Prentice, a.k.a. Christopher Honey Love. You want to say something here. Say it.
I'm not sure. I mean, I feel like he did what he was supposed to do, though. As far as getting heat in that role.
Yeah. That's another one I got to think about. Mr. Alan Martin in Continental.
Come on. I think this is almost that's because it goes against your idea of what a good manager is. You know, people's idea. Do you get what I'm saying? With Alan Martin and to an extent with Christopher Love.
Well, there's a couple more on this list. Let me read them to you because I'll discuss what you just said. Babus from Global, another one I forgot about. Mr. JR, naturally. From ECW, Damian Kane and Hunter Q. Robbins IV, who I think both were terrible managers.
Damian Kane's wife was a looker, though.
She was all right. I mean, if you're into, you know, big fake looking implants, if you can have big implants, at least I want them to look natural. But you really can't have them look natural if you go from A cup to D cup. But that's just my thoughts on the matter.
I don't remember her looking like she had a boob job.
I could be wrong. What was her name? Lady Alexandra? Was that her?
Yes.
I would go back and check that, Vix, if I was you. But with that said, was he a horrible manager or not?
He was a horrible manager, but he didn't really do anything anyway. I mean, he didn't
But that goes into the equation. That goes into the why he's a horrible manager.
Yeah, but and also he rock and rebels himself on shows too. So that he also loses points for that.
Hunter Q. Robbins. Yeah.
Did I have to explain? Have I explained the term to rock and rebel oneself?
Before? Well, do that and I'll tell my rock and rebel story.
Because I just realized I know I've done it on other podcasts. I'm not sure I've ever explained it on this one.
I'm pretty sure you haven't. So.
See, Rock and Rebel eventually got a promoter's license in Pennsylvania and even ended up on the Athletic Commission. But to Rock and Rebel oneself or Rock and Rebel your way onto a show to play Rock and Rebel is to, as part of the deal where someone is using your promoter's license, make it that you are wrestling on the show. And forcing yourself onto the show that you have no place on, even if you don't, and you don't fit on it whatsoever. Like Rock and Rebel, you know, on like mid-2000s ROH shows.
That'd be crazy. Did he actually do that?
Yes.
He worked, Rock and Rebel was working Ring of Honor shows in the mid-2000s?
I believe there was a period where they used his promoter's license. During the split from Feinstein.
That's crazy.
There was at least one show he was on.
I just pulled out. I have my envelope here. You can probably hear me ruffling through it. While you were talking, I found the ticket. Saturday, July 15th, 1995, Coast to Coast Wrestling presents Summer Invasion 95 at the Nassau Community College Gymnasium, Charles Lindbergh Avenue, Uniondale, New York. $10 general admission, 7 p.m. showtime. I was at this show. I was out there with a friend of mine, Eric Benben, and a few other people. And we were sitting there, and there was a match with Doink the Clown. And whatever it was that tipped us off, we realized it was the Rockin' Rebel. So we started yelling at him.
Wait. The Rockin' Rebel is Doink?
The Rockin' Rebel was Doink this night.
Oh, my God.
The Rockin' Rebels is Doink. I don't remember if it was because of his boots or what it was, but we realized quickly it was Rockin' Rebel and started, like, you know, from the bleachers, not from ringside, but from the bleachers, you know, yelling about it. And it wasn't like anyone at ringside heard or noticed or cared, but someone cared. And that was a woman not too far away from us who we would find that was the Rockin' Rebel's wife. And she got on us, and it wasn't like leave him alone. It was like we were yelling, hey, it's the Rockin' Rebel, Rockin' Rebel. And we were laughing. And then she's like, I'm going to tell him he's going to kick your ass. You better watch out after this match. You should leave now. I'm going to get my husband to kick your ass. Like, I'm like 15 at the time. Like, he can't kick our ass. He'll get arrested. Like, it's not going to happen. So after the match, I mean, sure enough, she walks down the bleachers and she walks over to like where the little dressing room area is. And she goes over there and she's talking to Doink, who's now not wearing like the top, the wig. So it's like the Rockin' Rebel with his long hair and Doink face paint on. And she's pointing up at us and she's like, you know, like making, like pounding her hand with her fist, like pointing at us and like, yeah, hit them, you know, like telling her this. And we're like, what the hell's wrong with this woman? And then we could tell
what's wrong with this woman? She's married to the Rockin' Rebel.
Yeah. Well, then he like waves us over and we're like, let's go. Like, we weren't scared. Like, let's go see what he says. And he was cool. He was like, look, you know, I know you guys know who I am, but my wife, she's not in on it. And she's very protective. And
not in on it. She didn't know that he was working as Doink.
Well, I guess she did. He was the way he put it. But I mean, I guess just like the idea that there were smart fans or fans who were, you know, there's smart fans and then there's annoying smart fans, which was just what we were that day. And he was cool with it. He was like, look, you know, I'm sorry if she said anything to you guys. He was very, very cool about it. But that's my Rocket Rebel story. My one run-in with the Rocket Rebel that I recall. I could have another one I don't remember, but I think that was it.
That's literally the opposite of every Rocket Rebel fan story I've ever heard.
I know, which is what really kind of shocked me about it. But he was cool that day. A few more here, Bix. Dave Delahouse says, two of the most worthless managers ever were both in Memphis around 1994. Big Business Brown, who managed inexplicably Eddie Gilbert, and Ronnie Lotz, who managed the Moondog. That's the second time Ronnie Lotz's name has come up. I don't remember Big Business Brown. Do you?
I remember the name. I don't know if I've ever seen him.
Yeah, I don't remember him. Last week in the video playlist, there was a lot of Scott Bowden. And that's a lot of great stuff, actually. I thought he was really good. So some of that stuff could be seen in the video playlist from last week's show. Jay Doherty. I just thought of another horrible manager. Jason in ECW. Absolutely terrible. I'm conflicted on that one. He was a very different kind of manager because he was a wrestler manager.
Well, and also I think that goes to my thing of what I was saying earlier about Alan Martin and to an extent Christopher Love. That I feel like in some cases people might, and this isn't slacking on anyone that picked them, not be in your idea of what a manager should be. Like, I almost get the feeling that, like, I know we don't really have much Ken Ramey, but I get the feeling that there would be some people, if they saw Ken Ramey now, oh, from the little footage there is, would not necessarily get him.
Possibly. You know, the interesting thing with Jason is I remember when I first read about him in The Observer, not Jason Knight, but the character of Jason. And I forget exactly how Meltzer put it, but it was something along the lines of Paul Heyman has a new character, Jason, who is Rick Martel, you know, to the nth degree or something like that. And I actually read that as Rick Martel wearing a Jason mask, like doing the Jason the Terrible gimmick. So I was quite shocked when I realized, oh, no, it's a guy named Jason who's doing the model gimmick, a very modern version of the model gimmick, a very New York-centric version of the model gimmick from around that time. So that, and I believe that's it for suggestions for this week for the worst manager. But someone did ask, Martin Reed, why did Lou Albano think he had a job for life with the WWF, which is something we mentioned briefly last week? Because he did, until he didn't. It's really the way to put it. You hear many people, Bruno Sammartino being one of them. Bruno was always one defending Lou. Lou would get fired time after time after time for being drunk and disorderly backstage, and Vince Sr. would fire him, and then Lou would cry and Vince Sr. would rehire him. And Bruno's always talked about how he would go to Vince and be like, oh, come on, he's got a family, you got to, you know, I know he's drunk, you know. Bruno would try to like make it work for Lou. When Vince Jr. took over, the story has always been that there were certain people that Vince Sr. said have to have jobs forever. And I guess the names you hear are Fred Blassie, the Fabulous Moolah, Lou Albano.
Well, Moolah, I don't know, because Moolah did not stick around after a few years.
No, but I wouldn't be shocked if we find that she was being paid the entire time.
Right. I mean, maybe, but...
James Dudley.
James Dudley for sure, Dennis Dunn and Kevin Dunn.
Did Vince Sr. say that?
I think Dennis Dunn at least, yes. I don't know if Kevin would have been actually part of the package at the time.
Okay. But, so that's the story. I mean, right? Is that the story you've always heard, that Lou Albano was one of those names?
I'm not 100% sure if he was one of those names, though. But the gist of what you're saying is my understanding, yes.
Right. And again, Lou was someone who, when in his drinking days, he would get really drunk and do things. I mean, I know there's a story that Shane McMahon called him a fat man backstage and Lou slapped him. He slapped a teenage Shane McMahon like right in his face.
Even worse, he'd call Vince Jr.
Yeah, he would call Vince. He would disrespect Vince the way he did on promos like in the early 80s after Vince bought the company. Hey, Vinny Jr. He would just like yell at him and Vince McMahon did not like it. He was the one guy who constantly disrespected him. And that's why by the end of 86, he's gone. He makes an appearance in early 87 in the Piper's Pit before Hogan Andre. And for the most part, he's done. And on this topic, Bix, we talked last week about the Lou Albano Hotline 900 commercials. And we were trying to come up with who has been in the most 900 number of commercials. I found
commercials or just hotlines
or hotlines, excuse me. But I found commercials for Lou Albano's and they're in last week's video playlist. And I encourage people to go back and watch them because they're insane. There's one where he gets like arrested by the Samoan. Well, Samu's in a police uniform. And then there's an Indian. And then there's one where Johnny Valiant's there with him. And then there's one where he's answering like 50 phones. I tracked four different numbers. And those numbers are 1-900-660-9933, 1-900-660-4-LOU, 976-5858, and when you get this one, Bix, 1-900-909-4-LOU. So four different numbers that at least commercials exist for online currently.
Now, were any of those the trivia number, or were those all just straight up Captain Lou hotlines?
It seemed to be all straight up Captain Lou hotlines, and one of them said, like, you know, a lucky listener, a lucky caller will, you know, win the opportunity to have a one-on-one conversation with Captain Lou Albano.
But so it's not the one he did with Bruno and Coach Kurt.
No. So that's a fifth
one. We're going with at least five for Captain Lou.
At least five. I wouldn't be shocked if it's much more. But at least five. We found four where there's commercials, and we know of a fifth one. So I got to think there's more. Maybe there's a Super Mario hotline with him, too.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, so that's it. Four Captain Lou commercials in last week's video playlist. Go check that out. Another follow-up from last week, Bix. Billy Jack Haynes. And anyone who wants some Billy Jack Haynes, if you need your Billy Jack fix, last week's video playlist. I'm not going to put it in again this week because it was so much stuff, but I tried to really cover every place from Portland to Florida to World Class to the WWF to USWA eventually to his own OWF, his own organization, which we talked about last week on the show in 1988. But you and I discussed his first run in 1984 with the WWF, the aborted run, as it were, because he didn't go in. And we questioned what Vince would have wanted from him in terms of where he would have been placed. And I said that I don't know if he would have been, you know, above the Junkyard Dog or not. But a few people reached out. One is I believe there's at least two vignette videos that he did in 84 on a horse talking about coming in. I don't know if I'd ever actually watched those before. I'd heard about them, but it's the first time I actually saw them. They were on YouTube. They're in the video playlist. So there are two vignette videos of him announcing he's coming in. And then the other thing, one of our listeners, Brian Cannell, hopefully I'm pronouncing that right, sent in.
Well, is it spelled C-A-N-N-E-L-L?
K-I-N-N-E-L.
Because I was going to say, any relation to Dave Cannell?
I guess not now. But it is the World Wrestling Federation program. It looks like it would be from the end of 84, just because it is a winter theme, red and green colors. It's a sled ride.
Oh, I've seen this.
And it's Hogan, Wendy Richter, Billy Jack Haynes, and I think Barry Windham actually is the fourth guy, which is a little shocking here. So there was something in mind for Billy Jack Haynes. We just don't know exactly what. But like I said, anyone wants to know more about this stuff, check out last week's video playlist. It is the longest one the show's ever had. It's well over, I think, 200 videos.
Hey, hey.
Well, you know, they're long, they're short. I even put an entire episode of the King Biscuit Flower Hour with the band in there. So because we talked about that. But you go through there. There's various things. Good managers, bad managers, express tag teams. And of course, lots and lots of Billy Jack Haynes. So you can go there. On the topic of express tag teams, Bix. We named a bunch last week. I knew there would be someone we missed, and I mentioned it to Jim Cornette this week on his show. And he mentioned one I don't think I've ever seen, and it was a team that worked for Nick Goulas, or maybe it was, I should say, George Goulas, I'm not sure, in the 1980s when they tried to start up again. I forget. He named one of the guys in it, but he didn't remember both. But the name of the team, probably the worst of the names for the Express Tag Teams, the Stop and Go Express.
That'll do it.
What does that even mean? Like, the Stop and Go. I mean,
convenience store, the Stop and Go Express.
Yeah, it's easily the stupidest name for anyone out there. It's easily the stupidest name, the Stop and Go Express. There's nothing really else to say about that. Nicholas, ladies and gentlemen.
I was going to say it's a good name for a convenience store, but then I realized the convenience store names that make you think of going to the bathroom are not that great.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, do you remember On the Run here in Long Beach?
Yes. Is that not there anymore?
what is that now? I forget what the one by the mobile changed their name to. I'm not sure if it's On the Run anymore.
Oh. Maybe it's Sit Down and Relax. Another thing from last week on the show, shorts to pants. Wrestlers that went from shorts or short tights to wearing pants. And we named a bunch of people jumped in with suggestions. So I'm just going to read them without crediting anyone, just because everyone had the same suggestions. Terry Funk. I'm upset that I didn't remember that
me
one.
Too.
Ricky Steamboat.
Yes. I just thought of one and I'm curious if it's going to be here.
Yeah.
Dynamite Kid.
Dynamite Kid is not here. Good one, Bix. Tito Santana. I thought we said
Tito. I think we said Tito Santana.
Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert. You should have gotten that one. No excuses. The Iron Sheik.
Yes. Did we do Ricky Morton?
Yes, we did Ricky Morton and Robert.
I'm surprised we did Ricky Morton and didn't get Eddie Gilbert.
Yeah. Virgil. Here's two that one of them I think we should have gotten. The other one, maybe the oldest example.
Virgil went from literal shorts, though, to tights. He didn't go from trunks to.
That's true. So it's a little bit of an asterisk there.
Asterisk.
I just talked about this with Jim Cornette on his show. One of his listeners wrote a letter and complaining about the way he pronounced it. And I just did the exact same thing. Bill Dundee. We should have gotten that one, Bix. And then he went back. The last one, probably the oldest example, at least this week. We'll see if what else we come up with. Killer Kowalski. And that was a really good spot there by whoever realized that. Kowalski obviously was always wearing the regular wrestling tights. And then eventually in his old age got a wig and wore pants with lightning bolts on the side of it. So Killer Kowalski. So thank you everyone for contributing to that. I mentioned Travis Heckle's amazing artwork and the video playlist. Of course, Facebook.com/superpodcast. You can go there each and every week to catch up on all things involved with the show. Like I said earlier, if you want to see the Dr. Mike Lano, Jenna Jameson photo, that's where you go. Bo James checked in, Bix, and geez, it must have been now. It may have been a month ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, but we talked about Super Clash 83 and the booking of it, I guess, based around, you know, the Lawler match. And we said, who was booking that show? Was it Greg Gagne? And Bo pointed out it was Wahoo McDaniel was the booker.
Oh, you mean 88?
88, excuse me.
Super Clash 3. You said 83. Okay, that's what. Yeah.
Forgive me. Super Clash 3, 1988, December of 88. Wahoo McDaniel was the booker there. So that clarifies that from a few weeks back. I do want to point something out. One that directly relates to recent topics on the show. One that's just really cool. Both of these things will be posted on the Facebook page, so stay tuned. This is really cool, Bix. There are just these great video resources nowadays. And we've talked so much about Chicago wrestling and Chicago wrestling history and Fred Kohler in Chicago that I want to point out, for those of you who don't know, on YouTube is something called the Chicago Film Archives Wrestling from Chicago, the Russ and Sylvia Davis collection. And in this collection, you have perfect quality, amazing stuff of all these legends, Dick the Bruiser, Vern Gagne, Lou Thesz, Buddy Rogers, Pat O'Connor, everyone you could think of I'm losing my train of thought. They're in these films, and it's definitely worthwhile to check it out. So you may think some of these old wrestling matches would be dry. You'd be surprised how many really, really amazing matches are in there. And the audience's reactions really help put everything over the top as being great. And the other one I want to point out, and I don't know an easy way to just give this link, so I'm going to post it on the Facebook page because I believe it's still active. Someone put together a Google Drive with as much All Japan matches as he could possibly get on there. So from the beginning of All Japan up until, I think, 99 maybe, everything. So Terry Gordy, Steve Williams, Stan Hansen, Bruiser Brody, the Funks, and of course Misawa, Saruta, Baba, Kawada, Misawa, just everyone you could, Kobashi, I think I said Misawa twice there. Tenryu, don't forget Tenryu. But this is really cool. So all of you who have heard us talk about All Japan here on the show and aren't really familiar with it, and that high impact match type of match that they would have there, it will be posted on the Facebook page so you can all check it out. And hopefully that Google Drive stays active, Bix, because that's a really cool thing that someone did there.
Yeah, I would think that it would. I mean, it's kind of I wonder if anything like that could conceivably be shut down. I hope it's not, but I wonder at what point is it, you know what I mean? Like, it's because it's not a video site, it's a Google Drive that someone happens to be sharing the URL of.
Right. And from what I understand, I didn't hear it because
I was biting my tongue.
Yeah. Dave Meltzer apparently announced on Wrestling Observer Radio that it was like All Japan's version of like the WWE Network or New Japan's network. Is that correct? Is that what you've heard as well?
I listened to it. He did.
Okay. Well, there you go. But I will have that posted so everyone can check it out. And I encourage everyone to check it out because it's really cool stuff. A couple of notes on deaths. Bill Cardill just died this past week, Bix. I wasn't too familiar with him just because there isn't a lot of footage in circulation with him. But he was the longtime announcer for wrestling in Pittsburgh. He was friends with Bruno Sammartino. So when Bruno had the Pittsburgh promotion, he was the announcer. And he did the Chiller Theater there. He was known as Chilly Billy. And he was one of two announcers, Ray Morgan being the other, that Vince McMahon replaced. So I guess that means Championship Wrestling was the one with Ray Morgan, and what was All-Star Wrestling was the show with Bill Cardill?
I don't know. But did Vince replace him when he replaced Ray Morgan?
I don't know about timing-wise, but I saw it in several places, including from Dave Meltzer, who's pretty reputable when it comes to something like this, that Vince replaced both of them.
Hmm.
So that's not
that he did, but I there was no replacement Pittsburgh show, though.
No.
So that's what I'm trying to parse.
But the Pittsburgh stuff with him, I mean, I know people who have said in New York they saw him, Bill Cardill.
Hmm.
So, I mean, that show wasn't just in Pittsburgh, or there was a version of it that was cut for outside of Pittsburgh. This is something I need to crack down on and find someone who knows. And I'm sure someone will chime in, you know, momentarily and let me know. But that's something to look into. But on the topic of death picks, do you know what July 23rd was?
Hmm. July 23rd, anniversary of a death. I'm drawing a blank.
July 23rd, we mark 20 years since the passing of Herb Abrams.
Oh, that's right. Of course, I should have known that, actually.
The memorable passing of Herb Abrams. On cocaine, covered in baby oil, with a bat smashing up furniture, scaring women, chasing women, getting 911 calls. What am I forgetting? Fire extinguishers.
No, I think it was pulling fire alarms.
Pulling fire alarms.
He may have been. I think he was smashing. He may have been smashing like the glass cases with the axe and stuff too. And you said covered in baby oil, right?
Yes, I did.
Had two naked women running with him.
Now this was his office, not his home.
His office building. Yes, 3 months earlier, he had been arrested and charged after trapping and trying to rob a woman like in his office.
I just love the idea that someone's in their office and they hear like, oh, what's that ruckus outside? They open the door and there's little Herb Abrams covered in oil, coked up, naked, just smashing stuff with a baseball bat. That's the greatest image of all time. So 20 years.
I remember seeing that in the Daily News the next day.
Yeah, I posted the article a while back. And
it's on their site, too.
Wrestling Big dies in nude spree. Yeah. I mean, technically, is that a spree? When I think spree, I would think it's like a robbery. I guess I don't know the actual semantics of the word spree. Is spree just a run through the halls causing trouble?
That's a good question. Let's see. Define, : spree. Let's see what Google says. Spree. A spell or sustained period of unrestrained activity of a particular kind. Yeah, that's a spree.
Yeah, bingo.
That was certainly a particular kind of unrestrained activity.
Oh my God. That is the nude spree to stop all nude sprees. So 20 years since Herbo Turbo left the planet.
Ooh, I'm getting hungry. There's a Sammy Fishbox ad on TV right now.
What's Sammy's Fishbox?
I thought we had this discussion off air, maybe.
Bix, I could show you my Fishbox.
That's uncalled for.
What's Sammy's Fishbox?
It's a restaurant on City Island in the Bronx that we get ads for on Fios.
Oh, we did talk about that.
Sammy's Fish Box is the nickname I had from Sammy Steamboat.
Anyway.
You've officially gone into the gutter with Sue the Shooter.
Couple other things. A couple people mailed some stuff or sent some stuff in. I want to quickly say it here on the air. Hold on. Suzanne's right here, and she's giving me ketchup and a bunch of potatoes. Thank you. That wasn't distracting at all. But you look cute, so you get away with it. The beautiful people get away with everything. Professor Ouch sent something in. I'm going to read this really quickly. I don't know the year or where exactly this is from. I'm guessing it's a Boston program. I could be wrong, but Bull popular despite wild ring antics. Although he is one of the most hated wrestlers both inside and outside. Wild Bull Curry, the Hartford, Connecticut Thrasher, has as many followers. It was surprising to note this, but we found that out the other, this is the worst sentence I've ever seen. We found that out the other night. He was given a sound going over by Peerless Pete Peterson, the colorful Californian. Curry, apparently, was one of the last to leave the arena on this cold night, but he wasn't alone. When he had reached the lobby, there must have been at least 100 of his fans waiting for him to sign autographs to console him. While mingling with the crowd, one popped up. Quote, "You should have murdered the guy. Why don't you gouge his eyes out? Next time you get him, step all over him, and better luck next time, Bull." It must have given the Bull, as wild as he is, a deep feeling of gratitude to know he has some faithful friends, even though he is continuously given round after round of the Bronx cheer when he was in the ring. So I wanted to read.
I can't blame you for having trouble reading that. That was oddly.
It was very badly worded, and it was also faded. So like as I'm reading it, it's like the thing is just gets harder and harder to read.
I mistimed that. I was going to try to get that on that as this thing keeps getting harder and harder.
That's the first. Today's the day you decided to do Sue the Shooter for the first time.
Sure.
Can you do any more? Are you willing to do any more?
I'm literally just willing to say hello.
Do it again.
Hello.
Okay. It's a little more Miss Doubtfire than Sue, but I'll let you get away with it. Kurt Brown.
No, Miss Doubtfire would be hello.
Okay. Okay. Good point. Kurt Brown, friend of the show, sent in a couple things I want to go over real quick here. This is from Albuquerque, the Albuquerque Journal, February 11th, 1949. It is on Gorgeous George versus George Arena.
Oh, they had a match?
No. The headline is Gorgeous George wins court fight by default. Chicago, February 10th, Associated Press. Gorgeous George Wagner, professional wrestler, won a match today from Joe Arena by default in Superior Court. Arena did not contest Wagner's request for an injunction to restrain the rival wrestler from using the name Gorgeous George. The injunction was issued by Judge Frank M. Patton. Wagner complained that Arena copied his ring habits. These include being attended by a uniformed valet and being sprayed by cologne in the ring, before a match. So, interesting little article there, Bix. I didn't realize it was actually a lawsuit at that time, in 1949.
No, I had no idea there was any kind of legal action. I figured it was just this Jack Pfeffer thing that came later.
Well, on the topic of Jack Pfeffer, this isn't Jack Pfeffer. And I'm not going to read this whole thing, but I wanted to make mention of this. Another thing that Kurt sent in. It's from Kingsport, Tennessee, which is going to be a familiar topic here today. December 1927.
Wait, someone else sent us something in from Kingsport, Tennessee?
Yeah, two things on the show today from Kingsport. It's not from Bo James. This is from December 27th. A Tennessee promoter has a wrestler named Young Gotchenschmidt. So as Kurt wrote, a Pfeffer-worthy name if I've ever seen one. Obviously, a combination of Frank Gotch and George Hackenschmidt. Young Gotchenschmidt. That is some bullshit, bootleg bullshit right there. What do you even say to that, Bix?
That's incredible.
Well, on the topic of letters, I just briefly mentioned it before. And we'll go over this a little further. Matt Farmer, wrestling historian, everyone should follow him on Twitter, posted this earlier. And it is a letter from what would be famously known as the Hell's Angels in wrestling. At that time, they were still calling themselves the Dupree brothers, Ron and Paul Dupree. Paul Dupree would later gain infamy as Chris Colt, and Ron Dupree would continue using that name going further.
Also, they were known as the Comancheros as well.
Yes. And this letter is from the Dupree brothers in Kingsport, Tennessee, August 15th, 1967, to Jack Pfeffer, professional manager of the World Tag Team Champions, the Hells Angels, and the Dupree brothers. So he was already their manager. Care of the Piccadilly Hotel, 45th Street west of Broadway, New York, New York. So this is 67. This is a few years after he destroyed Chicago, and he's back in New York at a hotel, living in a hotel in Midtown Manhattan. Dear Jack, received your letter today. Was glad to hear from you again. Was glad you gave us the offer to make big money and hit the big territories like you said. We accept the offer, and we want you as our manager and personal booker here, as I told you. Excuse me, there's no sentences. It's just one big runner. I'm going to start that again. Here. As I told you, we are getting $400 a week for the team, which is $200 each. And it's only four towns a week, plus spot shows, and the trips are short. Monday, Johnson City, 17 miles. Tuesday off. Wednesday, Kingsport, Tennessee, home base. Thursday, Greenville, Tennessee, 32 miles. Friday off. Saturday, Rome Mountain, Tennessee, 47 miles. And the spot shows are Cumberland, Kentucky, 76 miles. Bristol, Tennessee, 24 miles. Leon, Kentucky, 93 miles. And Norton, Tennessee, 39 miles. These towns run on Tuesdays and Fridays. Paul and I agreed that the territory is trash after being in Arizona, and good money, and we can do better. You've seen us work, Jack, and think our team equals any in the country today with our Hell's Angels gimmick. It's different. Like you said, we are originals. Jack, what kind of deal can we get, money-wise? Please send this information. It's strictly confidential, and it's Paul and myself, no manager but you. This is the interesting part right here. And I'm going to have to guess what some of it is because it's a little cut off. But Paul has his friend with him, which he has had for a year and a half now. I have no one with me. I'm an old snapper. No, seriously, Jack. This is a well-mannered and real quiet boy, 23 years old, not a kid. But as you know me, Jack, our personal life is never brought into the business. And Paul is the same, strictly business. One more thing, Jack. Give us time to give George Grant a 2 weeks notice and 1 week to come to New York City to pick up some things, I'm guessing he's going to try to write there, for our gimmick, which they sell in the Village in New York. You know all the Hell's Angels are there, so you could buy their stuff there. Well, Jack, I guess this is all for now, so answer me as soon as possible, and we will to your advice. This is, unfortunately, Ron Dupree couldn't write. And we will to your advice, and we both you to handle us. We'll get you a picture of us together soon. Waiting for a reply real soon. As always, Ron Dupree, signed Ronnie and Paul Dupree, and it gives a P.O. box. A few interesting things about this. First of all, Ron Dupree didn't know how to write. Second thing is, this is his way of explaining to Jack Pfeffer that they are gay, and Chris Colt currently has a boyfriend, and it shouldn't be anything that alarms anyone because it doesn't interfere with their business. Is that the way you took it, Bix?
Yes, and I've seen this letter before, and what fascinated me about it was that my understanding was always that the two of them were a couple.
I had never heard that. I mean, very well could have been.
I mean, I remember, why am I forgetting his name? Also, Dale Pierce had written something to that effect.
Then maybe they were at different times. Obviously,
yeah, I think it may be that they were more on again, off again than people thought.
And they went everywhere together. Look, they went here. They're calling from the Kingsport, Tennessee territory. They mentioned Arizona. They would later go up to Seattle. They would later go to Detroit, where they probably had their greatest fame. And there's a lot going on here. So last week we talked about the Chain Gang on the show, and they were a biker gang. They wore swastikas and they looked bad and dirty. And eventually bikers drew them into a bar, shot one of them, and Don Fargo swam away after diving out the window. From what I researched, this team, which actually called themselves the California Hells Angels, had a run-in with the Hells Angels at least twice. And the first time they went out to California to meet with them and get their permission. And the Hells Angels granted the permission as long as they didn't call it the California Hells Angels, just the Hells Angels. And according to Dean Silverstone's book, which we'll talk about shortly, he was visited by a Hells Angel who also made the same insistence. You can't call them the California Hells Angels. You can just call them the Hells Angels.
Because the California Hells Angels is the actual biker gang.
Yes. So that was there, and I just found this fascinating. And it made me go back and get Dean Silverstone's book out and look into it. There's only one match I know of with the Hells Angels existing on YouTube, and it's them from, I want to say, maybe 68 Detroit.
I think it's 69 against J.J. Dillon and Arnold Skull, right?
Yes. Yes. J.J. Dillon billed as Jim Dillon from, I think, Provo, Utah.
Cowboy Jim Dillon. It is what he considers his first pro match.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. I didn't realize that he considers that to be his first pro match. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's in his book that he had had, you know, the, like, I wouldn't say glorified backyard, but really untrained and not really working for real promotions matches, like in Jersey, like a couple of them. But this is his first, this is the first time after he's been broken in and been a referee for years that he's actually wrestling.
Now, where it gets interesting with the Chain Gang is after Frank Dillinger was shot and his career ended, he was replaced by Jim Dillinger. And Jim Dillinger, I believe, would be the guy who we're talking about here is Chris Colt.
I think so. That's what I was trying to figure out earlier. I mean, we were perplexed before we started recording. Like, my understanding was there was some commonality between the two teams. And I think we determined it was also they both used the Hells Angels names at different point. And so you're saying now that also Chris Colt was common to both teams in some form, or am I hearing that wrong?
That appears to be the research I'm doing, is that Chris Culp actually replaced Frank Dillinger. I'm going to try to double check on this.
Okay.
But Chris Culp as Jim Dillinger replaced Frank Dillinger. So we'll look into that, but fascinating stuff. I mean, just, you know, it always amazes me that there aren't more rock and roll themed teams from that era when rock and roll was exploding. But here are two biker themed teams in an era when, you know, the Hells Angels were, I mean, Hunter S. Thompson wrote his book around then about them.
Right.
So, I mean, they were getting a ton of publicity. And here we have two examples of wrestling trying to capitalize on that.
Yeah. I also just looked up on inflation calculator because they said they were making $200 a week each, right?
Yes.
In a territory with four towns, all very close drives, you can be home at night. What do you think $200 in 1967 money is now?
Ooh, $1,200 a week?
$1,443 and change.
Wow. Wow, living it up in Kingsport.
And I would think it'd be an expensive place to live, so that would be... That's over $75,000 a year.
That's pretty good.
That's not a bad living. I mean, that's, and they're at home each night too. So, I mean, you know, who knows with wrestlers and taxes back then? It's entirely possible that, in terms of inflation-adjusted money, they were each taking home more money than a lot of undercard WWE guys do now.
Yeah,
in Kingsport.
Yeah.
Working for a night, I mean, that's very interesting.
Yeah, I mean.
And they considered it low pay.
I mean, which says that they were certainly used to something higher in Arizona, which in and of itself is saying a lot because you never think of Arizona as some scorching territory.
Well, it wasn't an NWA territory, if I remember correctly.
No, and these guys tended to not work NWA territories because they go to Arizona, then they go to Kingsport. And
I thought Kingsport was NWA.
No, Kingsport was, and then they go to Detroit, which was, but then they go to Seattle, which wasn't.
Right. And at the time, as we'll talk about later, it was Dean Silverstone's Superstar Championship Wrestling, and not tied in with either the Portland or Vancouver offices.
And he points out in his book that Chris Colt was one of the biggest draws he ever had. that Chris Cult was business. I mean, that's what he keeps putting it. I put up with a lot of Chris Cult stuff because he meant business. And there's a lot of stuff in here, just different problems. And there's a story where every year there was some Native American festival where I think like six different tribes got together. And each year, Dean Silverstone's company would run a show in conjunction with that. And they would set up teepees as changing rooms for the guys. And after the Hell's Angels match, they were changing and the fans lit the teepee on fire and it went up in flames quickly. And the Hell's Angels ran out naked. And instead of looking like to stop the fire, they started punching out the fans. And then they realized they were outnumbered. So they ended up helping the fire department put out the fire by urinating on the fire. It's just the craziest fucking story. And look, we know that you and I are in agreement and Jim Cornette is and other people. Chris Cult is a fascinating guy that unfortunately there's very, very little footage of. But someone universally considered one of the most underrated wrestling talents of all time just because no one's seen him. He didn't get booked in any major territory. And he had a crazy life. He would later go shoot gay pornography for the Mitchell Brothers and other people. He eventually, I believe, died of AIDS. He had a lot of drug issues. There's a story in this book. He's working as a six-man in Mexico, and he took acid, I believe. And all of a sudden, in the middle of the match, he thought he was being attacked by giant spiders. So he stopped working and started rolling around on the canvas, fighting off the spiders.
I thought that was a cage match in the States, maybe in Arizona.
I had heard that too, but hold on. Let me see if I can find a story here, because I have the book in my hand. Let's see.
It is one of my favorite stories. Wasn't it that also the glowing spiders were scaling the cage? The giant glowing spiders?
I had heard that too, so I'm thinking maybe this happened more than once, as opposed to this being the wrong story.
Now, I'm guessing you know more about acid than me.
Yeah, I would say probably, yeah.
That is a thing that could happen, isn't it? That he
anything's like
a flashback or whatever. I mean,
yeah. Well, I'm sure it's not a flashback of giant spiders, but yeah, with acid or any psychedelic drug, magic mushrooms were always more my thing than acid. Your mind goes places. Your mind goes places, and anything like that could happen. You know, you want a happy trip, but yeah, sure. I mean, that could absolutely happen. I've seen Vikings sail on the beach of Lido Beach at midnight, and I had to fight them off with my cousin and a balloon. I mean, I've seen this happen. So, I mean, it definitely does. Here's the story in this book. In early 1974, just a few weeks before Chris came to work for me, he had been working in Mexico and was participating in a six-man tag team cage match at the Arena Mexico. He and his partners, Rene Guajardo and Alfonso Dantes, were working against El Rayo de Jalisco, Ray Mendoza, and Steve Wright.
Now, this seems like your first hint that it's a true story because...
The detail.
Do you really see Dean Silverstone in Oregon making up all these luchadors? No. And also, I believe Steve Wright was working in Mexico back then.
Right, and that Steve Wright, of course, is Alex Wright's father, Das Wunderkind, Alex Wright. Whatever substance Chris had ingested that night played havoc with his mind. During the match, he began to hallucinate, and he saw spiders and green scorpions crawling all over his body. He forgot all about the match and began to twirl frantically around the ring, swinging at the air and brushing the invisible creatures off his body. Instead of paying attention to the work in the ring, he began to swat the creatures off of his torso. Nobody, the other wrestlers or the fans, could see them except for Chris. The Mexican promotion was very upset over his actions, and Steve Wright may have saved his life by sneaking him out of the country the following morning. Chris wound up in Arizona and promised himself he would never again consume whatever it was he had taken that night. I believe he kept his promise because the incident didn't repeat itself while he was with Superstar, which is Dean Silverstone's company. So, I mean, there's a lot of detail there for that not to be true.
I'm just blown away.
Yeah, that's what happens with psychedelics, man. I would recommend anyone, you know, if you want to have a good experience, go to the beach late at night, full moon, nice weather, and listen to Screamadelica by Primal Scream. You'll have a good time. But that's the California Hell's Angels. Maybe let's see if I can get any more Chris Cult stories. I recommend anyone check out if you want to see Chris Cult. It's from a little bit after this when he's wrestling for was it Tomko?
I think it was George Cannon.
It's the Chris Cult experience, and it's just a total Alice Cooper ripoff. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but he's he's doing like an Alice Cooper kind of thing, and he does an elbow drop off the top rope before anyone was doing that. And that's a hard ring. You could tell that wasn't a soft ring. So check that out. Google Chris Cult Experience, and hopefully that comes up. And it'll be in the video playlist whenever.
I actually look it up on YouTube just to be safe.
What did I say?
I'm just saying that you said Google. And
Oh, yes.
Who knows
yes.
what? If you used Google and you have Safe Search off, who knows what a Chris Cult Experience would be?
Yes. Please, in fact, use YouTube for that search, not Google. You have a favorite Chris Cult moment or story or anecdote?
I mean, those are up there. I mean, I just wish there was more we could see of him, just because just about everything that existed of him is on tape is after Rhonda Prue died. And that's, by all accounts, the kind of the beginning of the end for him.
Rhonda Prue died, I think, in 75, while ring announcing for Dean Silverstone. He had a condition with his heart where he was told he couldn't wrestle anymore. So they made him a ring announcer. And this is a really interesting thing. His first match in 1960 was against Ripper Collins. And this match that he died at, the last wrestler he announced was Ripper Collins. And then while walking through the ropes, he had a heart attack and died instantly.
Huh.
So interesting little bookmark or bookend there. Ripper Collins' first match, ring announcing Ripper Collins, he passes away. So that's a interesting little story. But I guess that with that, Bix, it's a good time to talk about Book of the Week. Let's do this one last time. Book of the Week.
Book of the Week.
Book of the Week.
Book of the Week.
And this week's Book of the Week is I Ain't No Pig Farmer, the story of an old school pro wrestling promoter by Dean Silverstone with Scott Teal. It is published by Scott Teal's Crowbar Press. And like I said, this is a really interesting book. It is, let's see, about 280 pages. Lots of pictures, lots of reprints, lots of cool stuff. And it's telling an interesting story that you wouldn't think about. If you really think about it, the NWA had a promotion in Portland, which we all know about.
And in Vancouver.
And in Vancouver. So it's in British Columbia. It's in Portland. But what's in between? Seattle. And that was this company. And it wasn't affiliated with the NWA. It was an outlaw group. And it had a lot of interesting people working for it. People you may never have heard of. But the stories are fantastic. And if you're someone truly into wrestling history and want to learn about something that not many people talk about, this Seattle territory is definitely a good thing to start learning about. Let's see. Let me read the jacket on the back here. Let's see. In an era when few people were allowed into professional wrestling's inner circle, Dean Silverstone pitched the idea of publishing an arena program to Harry Elliott, the wrestling promoter in Seattle, Washington. Harry gave his blessing, and Dean's career as a wrestling publicist began when he was 14 years old. An entrepreneur in every sense of the word, Dean wrote, created, printed, and sold programs at Seattle's Senator Auditorium and Masonic Temple for the next 11 years. During that time, he also promoted spot shows, refereed, wrote, and handled publicity for Elliott's promotion, acting as a box office manager, and ran a few towns on his own. Dean never wanted to be in the spotlight. He simply wanted to write about, referee, and promote the superstars of wrestling. When Elliott closed shop and the other established promoters refused to work with him, Dean went into business for himself and formed Superstar Championship Wrestling. Dean tells about putting together a roster of talent and struggling to build his company, despite opposition from other promoters who considered him to be an outlaw. In the process, he faced anti-Semitism, collapsing rings, crowd riots, unpredictable actions from his talent, threats from Hell's Angels, the tragic death of one of his top wrestlers, and even a Molotov cocktail. Through it all, he developed a rapport and trust between himself and the wrestlers he employed. This is the story of a self-made man who, in his own words, was born at just the right time in history. Have you read this, Bix?
Not yet. I've been meaning to. It's on my to-do list. There are a lot that are.
Frank. Yeah, I'm right there with you. I have a giant pile of books next to my bed. But this book is definitely one people should check out. Another cool thing about it is if you order it from Crowbar Press, and we encourage you to do so, crowbarpress.com. That's Scott Teal's company. Let them know you heard about it here on the show. I believe the book comes with a free CD of promos that aired on Superstar Championship Wrestling. So again, it teaches you a little bit about a history that may not widely be known. And I'm a big fan of that. I'm a big fan of learning about things in wrestling history that aren't really out there so much. And I'm double checking right now, and it is on Kindle. It is on Kindle, of course. And with that, it's time to talk about tinyurl.com/605Amazon. And of course, that is our link that you can use to buy the Kindle version of I Ain't No Pig Farmer by Dean Silverstone and Scott Teal, or anything else you need, anything else you would buy from Amazon. Instead of just buying it regularly, use this referral link and we will get 6.5% of the sale approximately. And you wouldn't pay any more. You wouldn't pay any extra. It's just we get a little bit of a kickback for referring you to Amazon. And referring means you click our link or you type in the link. It's that simple. It's that crazy. And it is a way to support the show. This is a listener-supported show. So things like this really, really do help. And again, it is tinyurl.com/605Amazon. Bix, one last time, go over all the bounties and international links.
All right. If you're in Canada, tinyurl.com/605AmazonCA. If you're in the UK, Ireland, and the rest of Europe, tinyurl.com/605AmazonUK. The bounties are free trials of Amazon's subscription services, and even if you don't go beyond the free trial, we still get our bounty payment for referring you. And it's for two different things. One is Amazon Prime, which is Amazon's catch-all for free shipping, their Netflix equivalent video service, discounts on video games, various exclusive items and exclusive discounts, all sorts of stuff like that. That's tinyurl.com/605Prime. And there's also Kindle Unlimited, which is kind of like their Netflix for ebooks. And that's tinyurl.com/605Kindle.
That's right. And again, you guys know the deal. We're honest with you about how much money comes into the show from this Amazon thing. I don't think any other show is. You got a bunch of pretenders out there. And then you got the real deal right in front of you. So remember.
I have a question.
What?
Do you think they want people to think it's more or that it's less?
That's a good question. I think.
Or they just don't want you to know.
I just think they don't want you to know.
I think that's actually the right answer.
Yeah, I just think they don't want you to know. And in some cases with some hosts, I don't think they know, to be quite honest with you. But, you know, we're honest with you here. We tell you what the deal is. We tell you how much it helps the show. So, look, you guys know what's up. There are lots of shows out there, big shows, small shows, shows syndicated through a podcast network, shows that do things on their own. But remember, when you have to decide which show to support, remember which one pours this much effort and this much work into each week's show. Remember which show does all the interviews and all the other things you love on the show. So remember, when it comes down to us versus them, fuck those guys. Support the Super Podcast, your Super Podcast. With that, Bix, let's move on to the main event here today. And that is more of the what if and listener questions and suggestions that have really delighted people the last few weeks. People have loved this part of the show, and as of you and as of I. So this is a lot of fun each week, wouldn't you say?
Indeed.
Let's see. Let's start with a good one. And Joshua Warren, what if Jerry Lawler doesn't return back to Memphis after being sent to Florida when Jerry Jarrett got tired of him no-showing smaller towns after becoming champion?
This was what? Year
74.
Is this when? So is this the Florida War on where him and Jim White go as the mass superstars?
I think it may be after that, but I'm not certain.
Okay.
So the story was Jerry Lawler didn't want to go to certain towns. He was on top, and he was the top star. I mean, other than Jackie Fargo, and Jerry Jarrett said, "Then you can't work for me anymore." And that was not what Jerry Lawler expected. So Lawler goes to Florida, run by Eddie Graham, who was a mentor to Jerry Jarrett. And eventually he comes back and Jarrett builds everything around them. So what if that doesn't happen? Well, the first thing I think about from Jerry Jarrett's perspective, if Lawler never comes back, let's say he takes off in Florida and then goes to Georgia, Mid-Atlantic, somewhere else. The first thing is Jarrett loses a lot of his leverage whenever the blow-up happens with Nick Gulas.
Oh, for sure, because there's singular star. I mean, well,
he couldn't count on Fargo because turned on him.
Do you think Jarrett would be able to get Lance Russell if there's no Lawler?
Well, we know Lance didn't like Gulas, correct?
I don't know. I don't think I've ever asked him about that, actually, now that I think about it.
I thought I had heard that Lance wasn't exactly a fan of Nichols.
Well, maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought I had heard that. So, yeah, so what happens, of course, is Nick wants Jerry to push George Gulas at the top in Memphis. Jerry says no. Nick says, you better. Jerry says, I'm a partner. Nick goes, no, you're not. You've been paying us for an option. You don't actually own a piece of the company. Jarrett finds out it's true, sends a resignation letter, and gives up that money because his lawyer advised him that was the only way he would actually successfully be able to go out on his own without them stopping him. And he starts up and he gets Lawler on his side and he gets Lance Russell on his side, which means he has Dave Brown on his side. And he's able to take all of them over to WMC TV and present the package. Look, I have the biggest star in Memphis. I have the best program director in Memphis. And I have the biggest star on the news, the weatherman, Dave Brown. Let me air my wrestling show here and you get everything. And they went for it. Is that the right way to put it, Bix?
The only correction I would make is that Lance retired from TV program.
Yeah, he wasn't actively program. Yeah, he wasn't actively a program director at that time, but he was alleged.
He retired from HBQ, I believe, to take the Jarrett job.
Yeah, and he was a legend in the area, though.
Yeah.
In terms, and not necessarily in terms of the viewers, although maybe
it
in terms
both.
Of viewers,
it was both.
But the people behind the scenes, they loved Lance Russell. They knew Lance Russell. They respected Lance Russell. So if Jerry Lawler doesn't return back to Memphis, you don't know where his career goes. I'm not sure where he would have fit perfectly at that time. I mean, he certainly was very comfortable working his home territory. And I don't know if Jerry – what?
Yeah, go ahead.
And Jerry Jarrett, I don't know if Jerry Jarrett ever really has the leverage to move against Nick Gulas because he doesn't have a top star, because the other top star for years in that territory was Jackie Fargo. And when Jarrett went against Gulas and thought he had Fargo and Tojo, they both continued to stay with Gulas.
I think Lawler does turn out fine, though, because Jim Barnett was a big fan of his. You know what I mean? I think he had enough allies that he does fine.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, I don't think he's going to the Northeast.
Oh, come on. No, of course not.
But, you know, I think he would, you know, would he fit into Mid-Atlantic wrestling with his promo ability? Anywhere that had studio wrestling, he would have worked. Anywhere that had studio wrestling. Would he have gotten along with Ole Anderson? No. No. But any place that had studio wrestling, Jerry Lawler would have worked. And even if he didn't go to the west side of Tennessee, he would have worked in the east end of Tennessee. He would have worked there perfectly.
He could have gone to San Francisco, which apparently was a plan at one point, that Barnett wanted him to get work for Shire.
And yeah, and San Francisco wasn't dead yet. It was a few years away from dying.
No, I mean, at that point, still far from it.
Yeah. So, you know, even Los Angeles. I don't know how much money would have been there for him, but he could have gone to Los Angeles, too. And a lot of people were doing San Francisco and Los Angeles. You know, in the next few years, they'd be doing both. Piper and Moondog Maine did both at the same time. So.
Well, Los Angeles would have been good for him, too, as a smaller guy's territory.
Yeah. I don't think he would have made it in Japan. So it's really, it comes down to those territories. And yeah, Lawler would have been fine. Jerry Jarrett, who knows? I mean, it changes history for Jerry Jarrett if he doesn't have Lawler.
I think the 70s Lawler could have done okay in Japan. I mean, he would have been a junior heavyweight, but so he would have had to have gone once they had the junior heavyweight division. But you got to remember, 70s Lawler, especially before he settles into as a top guy in Memphis, is not the Jerry Lawler we think of in the ring. He's much more of a big bumping style heel.
Yes, but, you know, Japan was a harder hitting style that he certainly never enjoyed.
Sure.
As opposed to just taking big bumps for a big moment in a match. So I don't know. In my mind, I don't think Lawler even then in the 70s would have worked in Japan. Just because he wouldn't want to get his ass kicked. He wouldn't want to, sure. You know, yeah, so I don't know about that. But good question there. Here's one, Bix. This is from Brenna Elise Dugan. And it actually is spelled Dugan. It's not like I'm doing the Bill Watts, Jim Duggan thing. What if the Von Erich tragedies wouldn't have happened? Do you think World Class would have survived?
I mean, it's a territory, so probably not, but... it's tricky. It's because they were based out of a major market.
They were. It was a very short roster, as I pointed out before. And, you know, if they don't have the tragedies, that means David, you know, that's the really big thing to think about. David's alive. So in 1984, David's alive. I mean, does anything keep Fritz, keep his relationship with the NWA?
I mean, he would still be disillusioned for the same reasons, though.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, we've talked about Vince McMahon's desire to have the Von Erichs and his attempt to try to have a merger of sorts with Fritz. And the kids certainly wanted to go national and were pushing it, you know, according to Kevin. I mean, I don't know if they don't have the tragedies. I almost feel like the company has the same trajectory in a lot of ways. The fans probably don't get burned out as much in terms of tragedy after tragedy. I mean, first thing is I hadn't even thought of it this way. If they don't have the tragedies and David doesn't die, is there a Texas Stadium show in May of 84? Probably not.
I'm trying to remember. Do they claim they had already booked Texas Stadium?
I don't know, but
I could go either way on that one.
You know, but then what are you doing? Are you doing David versus Flair? Or are you doing Kerry versus Flair?
And you're
certainly not getting 32,000 people in there, probably.
No.
Although it would be a good crowd, because I mean, World Class was at his hottest. They were still at their peak at that point.
Yeah, I think if no matter what, if they're doing a Texas Stadium show, they do draw. And they did. It's not like they didn't do strong stadium crowds for non-memorial shows.
Yeah, that's true.
Like the Cotton Bowl shows never had a memorial tie-in.
Here's another interesting way to look at it, too. If David lives, what do they do with the Von Erichs versus Gino and Chris feud? Because now you have a third Von Erich in the mix.
Huh.
The main event Von Erich. I mean, the first big Von Erich.
They keep Jake in the mix and they keep it as a six-man feud.
If Jake would stay. I mean, I don't know if Jake would want to stay there. I mean,
Sure. But I mean, he was part of that group with them.
He was. He was initially part of that group for a short period of time, relatively. And then by the end of 84, he goes to Mid-South. And we all know about the relationship with Jake and his dad. But Jake's dad was there. Jake's dad was, you know, Bill Watts' right-hand man. So he had his family there. And, you know, certainly him and Watts have had a lot of things negative to say about each other since. But at that time, Jake was pushed hard to the top. He became North American champion. He had the TV title. He got over so good as a heel that he turned babyface.
He got a big push as soon as he came back.
As soon as he came back. I mean, within a month or two of when he came back is when he had the thing on TV where he DDT'd Terry Taylor on a chair. Like shoot DDT'd him. Not that he like tried to hurt him, but Terry Taylor got messed up on that DDT.
It seems like Jake's talked about that maybe you could, but at least the way he thought that you couldn't really try to DDT someone onto something and have it work. Like, he's talked about this with the Steamboat thing on the floor, that, like,
yeah,
he knew that it would hurt him.
Yeah, that one's still brutal. That one's still just amazing to watch. I used to love those videos Bill Watts would do to show, like, all the highlights. Like, you know, here's Jake, you know, DDTing Terry Taylor, and here's, who was it? Was it Terry Taylor? No, it was Dr. Death hitting Terry Taylor with the football helmet. It's like all these clips of guys getting legitimately hurt.
Steve Constance and Tim Ashley quitting wrestling.
Yeah. Yeah. There was some guy that Butch Reed like power slammed onto his, not power slammed, press slammed like just right onto his head.
Is it Tim Horner who like
has the bloody nose? Comes up from a clothesline with a bloody nose.
There's one that, I'm trying to remember who it is that does the flip over the guy who's trying to back suplex you and do the cradle spot, but as he's going over, it lands directly on the top of his head. I'm trying to remember who it was.
I don't know if that was Horner. I don't think it was.
Or Brad Armstrong? Or
not sure.
You remember what I'm talking about, though.
Yeah, I remember those videos. I dubbed the hell out of those videos. So, yeah, I remember those videos pretty well.
And, of course, the Jim Ross intro for one of them, where he's talking about how he was watching WWF television and he saw the Steamboat Morocco angle where Morocco attacks him with a chair.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget the line about how it was a dilapidated chair.
Well, it's funny you bring that up. The one I remember is Bill Watts' intro where he goes, you saw him hit him with a chair. It's not like Titan Sports where they have a wooden chair that's gimmicked so you hit it and it breaks evenly. You know? It's like he just completely.
And he always said Titan Sports too.
Titan Sports. Always. Always. So, but yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. World Class still has the same trajectory, probably, even if David lives. Because, I mean, if you're saying none of the tragedies, that means David and Mike lives. Not that Mike would really have been a determining factor in the success of the company. You know, who knows? I mean, if things had worked out and he hadn't had the toxic shock and he improved, who knows? But at that time, you can't really think of him that way. You know, the World Class kind of has the same trajectory, I can't see them surviving into the 90s, really.
Plus, a lot of guys were homesteading, you know, the top heels were homesteading the territory for a while, too, so maybe there's not that much turnover.
Plus, who knows if David lives, considering what he did in 82 by going to Florida? Who knows? Maybe in, like, 87, 88, he says, I've had enough of it here. I got to do something else. And he goes to Crockett. I mean, who knows? You really don't know. And I mean, when we talk about their survival, look, the crowd started dwindling. They got fans got turned off to the tragedies and the exploitation of the tragedies. And the Von Erich sold, what was it? Fritz sold his half of the company to Jerry Jarrett, and then Kevin and Kerry held on to theirs for a while.
It was, I believe it was something like Jarrett got 40% for coming in and helping clear the debts. And Kevin and Kerry each had 30.
Right. So, I mean, it changes that, too, because you got to think David would be in the mix then.
Right.
Unless he was in Crockett, you know, and pissed off his dad or anything.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say. That's the hardest one there is, really. That's like, you know, what would happen if Magnum TA hadn't had the car wreck? I mean, it's just, it's one of those hard ones, but let's go through a few other ones here. Here's one for you, Bix. Jamie Hamma. Hey, what if Vince McMahon ignored everyone and went ahead and pushed Tom McGee from 87 on?
Was that ignoring everyone, or was that also just seeing what was in front of him? Once he saw him wrestle people who were not Bret Hart.
Maybe. I mean, that's the thing. When you hear the Tom McGee story, it's easy to forget he was actually there for, what, 3 years?
I've never understood whether or not he was always with them throughout that, or if he was stopped working for them at times.
Well, All Japan was before he started there?
I think the first All Japan match, like the Choshu match, is before he started there. But then Wajima's, I think, in 87, right?
Yeah. Worst match of the year.
Yeah.
Yeah. I believe so. If it's not 87, it's 86, but I think it's 87. Yeah, so, I mean,
After the Brett match. It's after he signed or whatever happens, though.
And Jamie wrote this. I left this out. Oh, wait, we know what it would have been like. Roman Reigns. And you can't say that. It would not have been like Roman Reigns.
Roman Reigns is a much, 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 much better professional wrestler than Tom McGee.
It's not about the level of professional wrestler he is, though, Biggs. It's about if the fans would have accepted him. You know, because again, I'm not sure how much Jamie's familiar with Tom McGee, but what if Vince McMahon ignored everyone and went ahead and pushed Tom McGee from 87 on? He wasn't ignoring the fans. It's important to note that the fans, they really got to see him on house shows, and he was impressive in limited bursts. Big, muscular, steroid guy who could do flips. It's impressive. I mean, and he wasn't like, you know, 5'6". He was a tall guy, too.
It's just the problem was he looked dainty. Is there a better way to put that?
It's actually the exact perfect word to use. I didn't think of that one before, but why did he look like that, Bix?
The way he moved and threw strikes was dainty.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of looked like, I don't know, like Billy Squire and Rock Me Tonight on steroids, right? Just kidding. But he had the big hair, and He impressed everyone with the Bret Hart match. As Dave Meltzer always says, they didn't realize that it was Bret Hart who was the star at that time, not Tom McGee. He stayed around for a few years until at least 89. He was still doing house shows. He did the dark match with Arn Anderson. He was a babyface and a heel at various times. I guess the big thing with him is, how would you compare him to the Ultimate Warrior?
He's a dramatically better athlete, but he doesn't have the weird charisma that the Warrior had.
That's probably a perfect way to put it. You can say whatever you want about the Ultimate Warrior in the ring. The Ultimate Warrior had a charisma that connected with people. Tom McGee didn't. Tom McGee was just a guy with a look and a flip. So
you would think, you hear about Tom McGee and you see what he can do physically, you would think he would be the most amazing pro wrestling prospect ever.
Yeah.
He was a gymnast. He was a strongman. He was a bodybuilder. He could do karate. He could do all these things. But just he never got better.
Yeah. And I mean, that's really it. I mean, there's really not much more to say. Are there any other examples you could think of Vince signing someone, thinking they'll be something, and it never even remotely pans out? I guess at one time he signed Little John, Silo Sam, right? John Harris.
I was reading something about that earlier. I thought of a great one, though. I'm assuming there was a signing. I mean, we may be using the term loosely, but mm-hmm. I thought of a good one. Lisa Sliwa.
Yeah. In 84, 85, I forget. Lisa Sliwa, the then wife of Curtis Sliwa.
Now Lisa Evers of Channel 5 News in New York.
That's right. She looks nothing like she did as Lisa Sliwa. Curtis Sliwa, of course, started the Guardian Angels, the subway vigilante defenders of the 1980s. They're still around.
Vampiro, I think, is still in charge of the Mexican branch.
Vampiro's in charge of the Mexican branch. You know, whenever you see them now, they never look like the tough guys they looked like in the 80s when you see them and they're muscular. I've seen more out of shape guys in Guardian Angels outfits in New York than I have like guys who look like they're in shape and could fight, which always makes me laugh.
It's great when you walk past Curtis on the sidewalk and he's always wearing the Guardian Angels gear, even though he's coming from his radio job or whatever.
I just love the idea. He dreams up the idea for the Guardian Angels. And he's like, we need a beret. Like this is the outfit he chose. Like this red jacket and the beret. And it's just so silly.
I don't know if it's that it's so easy to notice him or what. He is the celebrity I've walked past just on the sidewalk more than anyone else by far, if ever.
Huh. Let me think. Who would be? Kevin Bacon, I think, is mine.
Really?
Yeah. When I was working at Sony, and I'd walk up from Penn Station to my office on 55th and Madison, I saw Kevin Bacon at least 3 days a week. Because he must have had an apartment over there. So he would be like walking the streets, coincidentally, right around the time I was going up there. I also almost hit Antonio Banderas with a car twice on two separate occasions.
God.
But that's just New York City life for you.
For a second, I thought you were going to say Antonio Sabato Jr., and then I would have been angry that you didn't.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't have known who he was. I knew who Antonio Banderas was. Other examples, I guess Mad Maxine kind of goes into that category because they had her ready to be in the Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling cartoon.
Yes, although wasn't that more of a Moolah power play thing?
It could have been. I mean, she only lasted, I think she was only on Championship Wrestling once, and then she was on All-Star Wrestling once. I mean, she didn't have that many matches on TV when they already were making, she was already in the plans. So, I mean, even if you say the Moolah power play was to replace Mad Maxine with her, Maxine was in those plans to be the big Wendy Richter heel until it fell apart.
Yes.
Who else? Wendy Richter. Lisa Sliwa was a very good pick there.
Lisa Sliwa, I can't find any results right now on History of WWE, but I could have sworn I've seen results for Lisa Sliwa before, that there was like one.
Oh, I didn't know she ever wrestled. I thought it was just they built her up that she was going to wrestle.
Right, the primetime wrestling thing where she's doing the modeling shoot. And
she was on TNT, wasn't she?
That's right, TNT. I meant to say TNT.
Yeah, I don't remember her ever wrestling. I definitely felt growing up, like in the late 80s, that they probably wanted William Refrigerator Perry at some point.
Perhaps.
But who else did they have in their grips in that classic era that they thought was going to be huge, or they thought they were going to do something big with, and nothing happened?
I love that, by the way, that you always say huge is huge now.
Yeah, well, it's – I can't prevent it.
I can't think of anyone else right now that was just there and gone. I mean, do you think they had big plans for Outback Jack?
Jesus Christ, they built the guy up for what, a year?
I don't know if it was a year. It was a while. They did a lot.
It was a long time. I mean, look, if there was ever a time to do something like that, it would have been during that time. Crocodile Dundee was big in the culture here in America. I don't know what people thought. Australian listeners, I'm wondering what you guys thought of Crocodile Dundee when you first saw it with Paul Hogan. Please let me know. I'm actually curious about that. I don't know. I mean, Outback Jack's a guy who I think maybe they have big plans for him, but I can't see why he would have gotten over.
He wouldn't have.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's like I could see why Tom Mickey would have gotten over.
In theory.
In theory. Outback Jack, I don't see.
Okay.
Who else?
I think Ted covers it.
Ted Arcidi. Did they ever think they were going to get more out of Ted Arcidi?
I don't know about that.
All right, Bix. A few more what ifs here before we wrap things up. Let's see. Tony Swish. What if Vince McMahon Sr. accepted Andy Kaufman's offer to wrestle in New York? That's an interesting one. He never would have.
Even if he had, it wouldn't have turned into an angle, and there wouldn't really have been anything to it. I think that's a fairly simple one to answer.
Yeah, there wouldn't have been a Jerry Lawler-like angle. It would have just been, even if they had gone with it, it would have been a one-time thing at Madison Square Garden, and that's it. Here's a one on the same topic I think we can go through pretty quickly. John McClary, what if Kaufman Lawler failed? Whose career would it have hurt more? Well,
define failed.
Plus, I don't think it would have hurt anyone's career. I mean, that's the thing. If you're talking about failed, technically the feud wasn't a major success.
It was never really a money-drawing feud, no.
It got a lot of publicity, and it was good for Jerry Lawler's career outside of Memphis, but it wasn't a major money thing, and it went on forever to the point where, by the end of it, it wasn't a money thing really more than the average program in Memphis.
I mean, it may have even been hurting them.
Yeah. Whose career would it hurt more? I think the whole thing hurt Andy Kaufman's career a whole lot more than it would have ever hurt Jerry Lawler's career in any way you look at it.
Oh, yeah. I don't see how it could have even hurt Lawler's career under whatever hypothesis we're going with.
Yeah, I don't see it either. So that's out that one. Here's one, Bix. Edward Whipke. Why didn't Terry Funk work for War? Was there heat between him and Tenru, loyalty to Baba, or something else? Well, during that time, he was working for FMW.
He wasn't working for All Japan anyway. So.
Yeah, he was working for FMW, which was Onita, who he, of course, had a relationship with from working for Baba. So I think that's really it. He worked for FMW, and then he worked for IWA, right?
And then he worked for FMW again.
And then he worked for FMW again.
Briefly had worked for New Japan, like as in one or two shows. In 95.
It's been a long time since I looked at his book. Do you remember what exactly happened with him and Baba that led him to leaving All Japan?
I don't remember at all.
Because, you know, he had the retirement match in 83, but then he came back.
In 84.
In 84, and then he was gone for the WWF, but he came back after that.
In 86, 87, yeah.
Yeah, but then he's gone, and next thing you know, he works for FMW. I wonder what the story behind that is. I got to go back and refresh myself. And then on the topic of Terry Funk, Steve Zai or Steve Z, one or the other, Z-I-E, Steve. what would have happened if Terry Funk would not have burned out and stuck around the WWF for a few years in the mid to late 80s?
What exactly did happen?
I believe he got burned out.
On the schedule. Well.
And he's not the only one. And look, quite frankly, his buddy Jack Briscoe did a few years earlier.
Good for him for deciding he was burnt out.
Yeah, really. I think it is one of those examples, though, where he left without giving notice, and he said that his horse got sick, He went back.
No,
to
that
Texas.
Was 93. 90. My horse is sick is 93 when he was going to take the booking job.
Didn't he pull something similar, or he just didn't give notice at all and just walked out in 86?
Maybe.
Causing Jesse Barr to instantly be pushed into the the Funk Brothers as Jimmy Jack Funk.
I'm trying to remember. I forget exactly what happened. And then also they framed it as, like, I remember on one of the old Coliseum videos, they framed it as that he had injured his knee and had in the WrestleMania 2 match and had to retire.
Huh. Well, one of many Terry Funk retirements, I guess.
Yep.
So if he had stayed around, I don't know. I can't see him staying around because he would have never gone up the cards again. He had his match with Hogan on Saturday night's main event. They had other things in line for Hogan. Terry was getting older. He, you know, the one thing I think you see in that, especially when you compare that Terry Funk to the Terry Funk a few years earlier and the Terry Funk at the end of the 80s against Ric Flair, where he was in phenomenal shape, was Terry. I don't want to say he was the most out of shape, but I think he kind of was the most out of shape Terry Funk during that time than any other time in his career.
In the WWF?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'd have to look back at it.
So, I mean, body wise, I don't know how much, you know, further he would have gone. Certainly wouldn't have gotten into that shape he got into for 89, but it's a tough question. It's a very tough question there. Bobby H. Blank, we answered your question earlier. What if Vince Sr. had said yes to Andy Kaufman? So I'm just going to like that one and cross that one off the list here. Two more, Bix. Let's find two good ones. John Boucher or Boucher.
Let's go with Boucher.
John Boucher. What if Bob Backlund agrees to turn heel for Vince in 1984? Alternatively, instead of turning heel, what if he agrees to work against Hogan as a buzz-cut, red singlet, all-American Bob Backlund? What do you think? I mean, Vince wanted him to turn heel. He wanted him to dye his hair.
Do you think he really wanted him to bleach his hair? That's just his story and his way of saying that he didn't want to do whatever Vince wanted.
I don't see reason to think Backlund's a liar.
I just feel like we've never actually heard the story outside of the Backlund version.
I've read through a lot of Bob Backlund's book. I think he's an honest guy.
No, I think he's an honest guy, but sometimes I've wondered if it was and I'm not saying he made it, he was lying. I've wondered if it was figurative.
I believe it, because I feel like that's a Vince thing. Like Adrian Adonis, dye your hair, you know?
I was going to say, until he brought up Adrian Adonis, I was going to say, he wouldn't make him dye his hair. Bob Backlund's not a black guy.
Yeah, Butch Reed, exactly.
Coco Beware.
No,
there's more. I'm trying to remember all of a sudden. Shelton Benjamin.
Oh, there are more black guys that he made dye their hair. Yeah, you're right.
Someone pointed this out to me once, and I was amazed by how many there were. It's more than just those three.
Well, I could see it, the Backlund. I could see, because again, he's coming off a long run as the top babyface. He was tired in terms of his act by that point. He had already shaved off his hair, and he had the crew cut in a singlet. I think him just acting like a heel, and I don't know if he would have been the Mr. Backlund type heel back then. I don't think he would have. But I think if you bleach his hair, it's instant, like, holy cow, this is a different Bob Backlund. So I see the merits in asking him to do that. But if he had turned heel in 84, like, where do you see him on those cards?
I don't see it having much steam, though. I don't see Bob Backlund in 1984 being ready to be a heel, even if he decides to do it. I think he's unsure of what he wants to do, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, he always said it was all because of his daughter growing up. He didn't want to be a heel while she was growing up, and didn't want her having trouble at school. So I don't know. And then his second part here, alternatively, instead of turning heel, what if he agrees to work against Hogan as a buzz-cut red singlet All-American Bob Backlund? I'm sure he would have agreed to that in 2 seconds. I'm sure that's exactly
what... Babyface match, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure that's just not what Vince McMahon wanted at all. I mean, I think there was something he could have done with a heel Bob Backlund, but for the most part, I think Vince was just tired with Bob Backlund. Is my hunch. So let's do one more here, Bix. Let me find a good one. That one's a good one, but that one would take a while. Nick Bassanz. What if Heyman, Gilbert, and Brooks made Continental successful and early ECW?
You mean Woods?
I guess he means Woods because it says Brooks. I don't know who Brooks would be.
Phil Brooks in a time machine?
Yeah, Rusty Brooks. You remember his partnership with Heyman and Gilbert? Well, first of all, it's Gilbert, not Heyman, for Continental. Heyman was just the understudy and the buddy and the best friend.
I mean, I guess technically he was the assistant, but still.
But still, that's Eddie Gilbert. It's Eddie Gilbert's fingerprints all over that show. If he had made Continental successful, he did make Continental successful. Just he couldn't.
I've heard otherwise.
Oh, really? Okay, I was going to say the issue wasn't anything other than he couldn't get along with David Woods anymore.
He was papering a lot of the shows.
Oh, well, there you go.
I mean, I've heard that from people. I've heard that from someone who was there, who was friends with Eddie, and wouldn't just say it to slight Eddie.
Okay, so that definitely carries some weight. Well, we're not going to end on that one, then. Let's get one more here, Bix. Let's see. Jonathan Hood. If Jim Herd, Jim Ross would have signed Roddy Piper in 1989, what would the possible matchups that could have been seen? Is he a babyface or a heel? Gotta be babyface. There's no way Piper's coming in as a heel, I don't think.
Yes, but at that point, Flair's still a babyface. Maybe eventually you set up a turn of Flair turning to do that, I guess, would be the idea.
Well, that's the other thing. If you bring him in as a heel, and this would have been early 84, 89, he is the one person you could have substituted into that Terry Funk role of being the Flair heel.
Yes.
Like, perfectly.
I mean, you could do the exact same angle.
You could do the exact same angle with Piper, and it would have worked. I mean, I had never thought of that before.
Literally the exact same angle.
Yeah. Impartial judge. At the end of it's being nice, says he wants, a title shot. Flair says
no. There's
a
wrestler who everyone thinks of as doing movies now.
Oh, my God. It's the exact same angle. I'd never thought of it in that way before.
Unless there's something I'm missing, you don't have the tie-in where I believe Roadhouse came out either like a few weeks before or a few weeks after Wrestle War.
Right.
But otherwise, it's the exact same angle.
Yeah, I mean, They Live came out in 88, so I mean, it's still fresh on people's minds.
Yes.
And it was a memorable movie, and people talked about it. Who would he have worked with as a babyface or a heel? I mean, if he comes in as a heel, that means, again, think about where Terry Funk ended up working. It's Piper against Sting, which I don't know. I don't know how that would have worked. Piper versus Steamboat could have been good. It's so weird thinking of him being in the mix. Maybe Bob Orton stays around a little longer and gets associated with Piper again.
Murdoch wouldn't be a main event program, but it would be fun.
It would be fun. He wouldn't be wearing the Hot Rod shirts because Vince owned the rights to those.
Did he?
I believe so.
Okay. I guess so.
I believe that was one of the first ones Vince merchandised and made intellectual property of Titan Sports.
Did he ever merchandise the Panther shirt?
I don't know. I was actually wondering that recently, too, and I went looking around for information about that. Because I always wondered, where did Piper get the Panther shirt, and how many did he have? I mean, he can't be the same shirt every week for a year and a half.
True.
How many Panther shirts did he buy? Did he walk into a t-shirt store and see these shirts like, oh, I love it, I'll have 40 of them? This is the kind of question we need an answer to. So I don't know about the Panther shirt. But, I mean, I think he would have fit in perfect with 1989 WCW. And I think he would have looked to get out of there as fast as he could in 1990. I don't think he would have worked well with Jim Herd. We know Piper and Ole Anderson had numerous problems before. So I don't think he would have worked good with Ole as the booker. Ole's style of dealing with people, as well as their personal heat from before. He would have done fine under Flair, Cornette, and Kevin Sullivan. He was friends with Sullivan, or friendly with Sullivan. I don't know how good friends they were. Best friends with Flair, and Cornette grew up idolizing him. So, it's one of those great what-ifs. Piper in 89. What if Savage in 89?
I mean,
Jim Herd talked to both of them.
But at what point would he be coming in? Like, because is he coming fresh off being a heel, fresh off being a babyface?
Who, Piper?
Savage.
Or Savage? Well, the question is, if Savage is negotiating with them in 89, I've never gotten a firm answer about this. When was it? What was it while he was champion? Or was it after WrestleMania 5 when he lost the belt?
I don't know.
Because that changes everything, too. Even though he got shorted, even though everyone says he got a really shitty offer, and that was kind of the end of it.
Yeah, I don't know about that one. So if he's a babyface, he's working with Sting versus Randy Savage in that era would be very interesting.
Oh, it would have been good. I think that would have been good.
Who else?
See, I can't see Muda versus Piper.
Savage and Muda?
Savage and Muda, I could somewhat see.
Savage and Terry Funk?
Gary Hart and Piper, I could see going at it with each other. In that universe where Piper comes in as a babyface. Savage and Terry Funk would have been really good.
Well, I'm drawing a blank all of a sudden.
Yeah. Well, it is late, and we should probably wrap this up here today, Bix. Well, for, you know, one last time here on the show, why don't you do your plugs?
Ahem.
Jesus.
I'm preparing. I got
do the Sue the Shooter hello one more time.
Hello.
All right. What do you got going on, Bix?
Follow me on the Twitter at David Bix. This week in Figure Four Weekly did probably the most detailed wrap up on the new WWE lawsuit that you'll find anywhere. Who's suing? What exactly is going on? Trying to explain it in ways that make sense to everyone. So check that out if you are a subscriber to WrestlingObserver.com. And if you're not, why aren't you? And subscribe and get access to that and Wrestling Observer newsletter and all the other stuff they've got there. What else do we have? Is there anything? I'm trying to think anything else writing-wise that I have this week. I'll plug the new ebook one more time, I guess. The Great White, W-I-G-H-T, the Big Show's last name, Hope. Great White Hope. It's the article I did for SB Nation in January with a bunch of bonus content thrown in, including Vince McMahon testifying about the original WrestleMania plans for the year that they had Big Show and Floyd Mayweather and WWE's version of what happened with Big Show and the boxing thing and all sorts of other stuff. Just $3, including on Amazon. Of course, use the referral code, the tinyurl.com/605Amazon or the UK or CA versions at the end for the relevant locales. It's also on PayHip, which I get a little bit more money if you get it through there. And it has I have for both Kindle and other readers. Just you pay the one price and you get both. It's also on Smashwords. And I think according to what Smashwords said to me, it should be available on just about every other ebook store soonish. It's hard to tell exactly what they were saying there, unfortunately. But there you go. And also, I neglected to mention this last week. It has cover art from our good friend Travis Heckel.
Oh, fantastic cover art for a fantastic book.
Thank you. It's just take a look. I think the cover art may motivate people to buy it more, actually, which was one of the reasons I kind of begged Travis to help out with this.
He did a great job. Yeah. And you did a great job. Good job with Thank that you. Book.
I mean, he that cover art is exactly what I wanted and described to him. So seriously, kudos to him. And I really want to thank him so much again for doing that because it is literally exactly what I had in mind. So there you go. Audio-wise, Between the Sheets, you know, every Monday on the PWO-PTBN network, we may finally be doing I was thinking about maybe finally doing an individual feed for the show because I know we were told a while back that everyone's cool with if we do that, so been hearing from some people more again lately about doing that. So maybe be on the lookout for that soon. As far as actual audio, we have up a couple things. We have the regular latest show, and we also have the best of that people asked us to put together. We took requests and stuff, and ends up being well over 6 hours long, and that is available as the latest show on there when this goes up. Got a regular show coming up this week, and we've also got one more first-year anniversary special. One we've hyped, just in case by some chance the taping gets canceled. I won't directly reference what it is, but it should be a good one. So check that out. Anything else specific that I've got to plug? Should be back on the Wrestling Inc. podcast this week. Hadn't really plugged that yet here, but for your current wrestling stuff, I'm on there kind of right now trying out a few different hosts to settle on who's going to kind of co-host everything. So that's why I haven't been on it as much the last couple weeks, but that's at WrestlingInc.com, and I think that's it for the plugs, right? I mean, I would know better than you, but...
You would know better than me, but that sounds about right.
Sometimes I'm not sure.
Sometimes you're not sure. With me, of course, you can hear me each and every week on the Jim Cornette Experience, except next week, actually, because Jim's doing a live show in Charlotte for the whatever that convention is down there that I'm not going to.
NWA Legends Fan Fest.
There you go. So he's doing a live show there for that, and I won't be attending, so I won't be on next week's show. I'll be on the regular drive-thru for those of you who listen to the drive-thru. And I know a lot of the listeners here are sending questions for that, so thank you. It always pops me when I see your names pop up in there, and I know so many of your names from the Facebook page. And also, a lot of the times when you say something complimentary about 605, I don't always put it on the show just because I don't want to make Jim uncomfortable, but I always read it. And thank you guys. I really do appreciate all the love. But this week on the Cornette Experience, which you can go to Facebook and just put Jim Cornette Experience on the in the search bar, and you can see it. We have Scott Williams on, and we talk a little bit about the WWE lawsuits and the independent contractor status for various wrestlers. Let me get to the show things now. Boy, my throat is really starting to go.
Tiny URL for doing so much in one shot.
Yeah, tell me about it. tinyurl.com/605Amazon. We mentioned it earlier. It is our referral link. It is your way of supporting the show without doing anything differently than you normally would on Amazon. Anything you spend, you use this link, and we get 6.5% give or take of the sale. You pay the same thing you would if you went to Amazon normally. This is a way to support the show. Please support your super podcast. Once again, tinyurl.com/605Amazon. All the other Amazon links are in the show post at 605pod.com, as well as tabs for donations. You can make donations to the show. David Bix's donation link is still there this week. So if you've been listening and you appreciate all of his hard work, make a donation. My donation tab is there. If you listen to me and you think I'm doing okay, hey, hook a brother up. Maybe you're a secret millionaire. You never know. But at the bottom of each show post at 605pod.com, you'll see make a donation to David, make a donation to Brian. Click on those links and you can make your donation 1, 2, 3. Again, it is a listener-supported show, so all things like that really, really do help keep the show going. And please do that if you can, if you are in a position where you can. Of course, on Twitter, he mentioned before, he's at David Bix. I'm at Great Brian Last. The show is at 605pod, 605pod for those of you new to the game. And of course, you can use the hashtag 605pod if you want to get out there and talk about the show. iTunes. Subscribe on iTunes, subscribe on Stitcher, subscribe wherever you need to subscribe, but it certainly does help us to have a bunch of subscribers. But on iTunes, you can also do another thing, and that is leave a review. Give us 5 stars, like your favorite matches, and also write a review about how much you enjoy this show. It really does help. It helps the Apple gods pay a little bit of attention to us, and I'm a shareholder. Those bastards should be paying a lot of attention to us, but they're not yet. But hopefully they will soon. So please, on iTunes, leave a nice review and give us a 5-star ranking. We really, really do appreciate it. Facebook. I've said it every week. You guys know how much I love the Facebook page. Facebook.com/superpodcast. It is a small percentage of our audience, but the most vocal part of our audience. And I know now we're having people join up who are not normally on Facebook. They're doing it just to see what's going on there. And a few people are using their wife's Facebook pages to chime in and say hello and stuff. And I really do appreciate it. I appreciate all that effort. Each and every week on the Facebook page, you can see the exclusive 605, exclusive 605, I say it again, show artwork done by Travis Heckle each and every week. He is an amazing, talented guy, and I am thrilled by everything he does, and it's always really good. And of course, you can see the video playlist when it goes up. You can find out when the show goes up. You can find out what's coming up on the show. You can vote on the top 10. You can vote on the championship match. You can vote on whether you want Dr. Mike Lano to be eligible for the top 10, and so much more. Pictures, videos, all sorts of fun stuff. It is the central communal zone of the Super Podcast. So once again, Facebook.com/superpodcast. One more thing before my throat is done. If you want to mail something to the show, there's an actual place you can mail stuff. and that is their P.O. box. As I take a breath, 605 Super Podcast, P.O. Box 1242, Morristown, New Jersey, 07962. Once again, that's P.O. Box 1242, Morristown, New Jersey, 07962. Whenever someone asks if they want to send something in, where they should send it, that's where you send it. So if you ever have something you want to send into the show, that's the place to do it. But
you forgot one.
iTunes, Facebook, hashtag.
Well, no, it's the alternate subscription stuff, which I guess I need to make you a script for.
Yes, yeah, I think you absolutely do. But what is that, Bix?
Okay. So if you don't use Apple devices, or even if you don't use iTunes for your podcasts for whatever reason on your Apple devices, there are other ways you can still subscribe. Now, a lot of the podcast apps, podcatchers, whatever you want to call them, they might have their own directories. If so, you can search for the show there. Sometimes, for whatever reason, their searches don't work well with things like numbers and punctuations. You may just want to search for the word Super Podcast as one word and not include 605 if you can't find it at first. If it's not in a directory that your app has, or if your app doesn't have a directory for whatever reason, you can also use the manual subscription option. Just choose that and then add 605feed.com as the feed, and that'll get you the show, and you can subscribe to that, and you're hooked up.
There you go, and then you're hooked up, and as we finish the donations, once again, Bix, gotta thank you for everything. Let me give you a little hand. It sounds pathetic when it's one person clapping.
What was that sound at the end? It sounded like there was a fart noise, too.
My butt is nowhere near the mic, so I don't think it was the fart.
There was like an air pocket in your hands, I guess.
I don't know. I don't know what the hell's going on. I don't know what you're hearing over there, but...
I didn't hear it the second time.
Okay. There's no air pockets the second time, but of course, Bix, this being the last episode you're co-hosting, I got to thank you here at the end of the show for everything you've been doing for the show and what you've helped me make this show is something I am very, very thankful for and appreciative of. And we started this little humble experiment, this little humble mothership on Thanksgiving, and it's come such a long way. And certainly this won't be the last time we hear you here on these airwaves or these podcast waves. I don't know if you call them airwaves if it's over a podcast.
I mean, if it's going over Wi-Fi, that's radio. I mean, cell phones are technically using radios. It's airwaves.
That's right. We're not really getting to the ionosphere, but we're close.
If you're using a wired connection between your computer or whatever, and then no airwaves.
There you go. But
well, most of you probably airwaves.
But as I was saying, Bix, thank you for everything here with the show, and we look forward to hearing from you more on the show. I know Sue the Shooter and the Black Scorpion will miss you, but they'll have to find new people to torture, which I'm sure you'll take a great joy in listening to from a distance, knowing you're not going to be hearing from them anymore. But sincerely, thank you for everything, and I look forward to doing more stuff with you in the future.
As do I.
Great. Well, for one last time here on the show, David Bixenspan is the co-host. Definitely a candidate for co-host of the year in the Sheedy Awards. I may tell people not to vote for me on the Cornette Show. Vote for Bix instead. But, of course, once again, thank you, Bix. And listeners, let us know what you think on the Facebook page. Let's have some Bix memories. Favorite Bix moments on the show?
No.
Okay, maybe not. But until next week, he's David Bixenspan, and I am the great Brian Last. Tally-ho!
Ha-ha!
Well, Chris, I'm sure after you taking care of Peter Caparella so quickly that the fans are into the Chris Cole experience.
The fans, my friend, the fans, man, have got a whole lot in store for them when they experience the Chris Cole experience. You understand? Listen. First of all, brother, I want to tell you right now what my whole trip is, what exactly I'm going to do. Everybody that this promoter and the promotion books me up against is going to be packed out and crippled. There's one thing I want you to remember, and that is, I told the lawyer, the attorney in San Francisco, the promotion, and yourself, Cannon, I will not be responsible for hurting, crippling, or putting anybody in the hospital that I wrestle up against right now, man. You know, you people right now are looking at the greatest talent in the wrestling business today.